Good morning, and welcome to the House Committee on Human Services. We got a full agenda, and we have two bills that we'd like to hear right off the bat, so I'd like to ask our colleagues, Senator Prozanski and Representative Nathanson, if they'd come up and get us kicked off. While they're coming up, I'm going to open a public hearing on both bills. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2858 and a public hearing on House Bill 2856. Representative Nathanson, I hope you know that we are glad to hear these bills. If we need to hear them further, the chair, co-chair and I have agreed that we will do this again, but for a half an hour, let's see what we can get done.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And members of the committee, I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from House District 13. I'm going to speak first to House Bill 2858 and ask if Senator Prozanski, it needs to go to another hearing right away. If the senator would like to make his comments first, that's all right.
I'll follow.
Okay, thank you. This bill has three objectives: to reduce child abuse through early intervention, to save state funds used to investigate multiple and recurring reports of abuse and avoid foster care and other costs, and to provide information to and support families in need. The basic notion of this is this: Department of Human Services caseworkers who investigate child welfare reports are prevented from further involvement with the family if there was not sufficient evidence of abuse or neglect. They may recognize things aren't quite right. This may be a child or a family in trouble, but there's not enough evidence and they can't proceed. This may lead then to elevated risk for the child if the family is still in need of services. This bill develops a pilot program that applies to families with children up to 5 years of age where an investigation by DHS can't substantiate the report of alleged child abuse. The pilot program requires DHS to refer the child and the child's parent to the relief nursery within 24 hours for an assessment of needs and resources that would be available to the child's parents and recommendations for appropriate interventions by local resources such as respite services, parental education, alcohol and drug support services, mental health services. We know about a number of similar programs to Relief Nursery around the state, so you may ask, why is this pilot program about Relief Nursery? Well, frankly, it's because this idea had been kicking around in Lane County between the Relief Nursery and DHS down there in Lane County. It's been kicking around for more than a couple of years now, and I decided it's time to do something about it. We recognize this will save children, this will save money. It's a good idea. Early intervention is always a good idea. I'm concerned that we're basically turning our backs on kids and their parents if something hasn't gotten bad enough already, if someone hasn't been hurt. But what if that child might be in danger of abuse or neglect? This bill says, let's stop ignoring the problems. Let's not wait until something really bad has happened. Let's help as early as possible. Thank you.
And, Senator, before you start, since we've opened up public hearing on both bills, if you can, and this is true for anybody else testifying, identify which bill that of the two that you're specifically directing your questions to, if there's a difference. For the record, you were speaking, Representative Nathanson, about 2858.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's correct.
Senator, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, and committee members. Thank you very much for allowing me to have an opportunity to testify on House Bill 2858. I'm here to also to lend my support for the concept of the pilot program. I have three different programs that are similar in nature within my district. Of course, the larger one, which is Relief Nursery, and that serves Lane County, that's housed in Eugene with satellite offices. We also have the nursery that's in Cottage Grove and one down in Roseburg area. Mm-hmm. What I've learned and understand from working and being, briefed on at each of these nurseries, the essentials of having early intervention, the earlier you can intervene, the better the results can be. And there are times where families that may actually realize they really need help, but they don't know how to get help or how to actually take that first step. And I believe this is an opportunity to have a win-win situation of where the public and private and then private being nonprofit, organizations can work together to actually get families into the programs, get the kids in the programs, and actually for us as a state actually save us money at the very front end. And because we know with that early intervention that we will in fact cut the time, the need for other interventions in the future. As most of you know, my day job is a prosecutor. I work in an area where I see kids coming into the system, and unfortunately many of them stay in the system. And what we need to do is break those cycles, and this is one of the ways that we can do that, because you actually help the skill sets of the parents to be better parents and dealing with issues that they may have personally, could be just being under stress, and how they are coping with it is the wrong way, and it's not modeling properly for their own kids. And that's part of the cycle that we want to break. You're going to have a number of certified smart people that will be speaking after both of us. We really encourage you to listen to them, because they are the ones that are down in the, on the rank and file, down in the field, and actually doing the work. And they can tell you how it's been, the successes they have had. And I hope that we will, in fact, go forward. As Representative Nathanson says, this is a pilot program. We understand that many, even here on the committee, may have similar programs in your community. But what we are asking you to do is use one of the most long-lasting programs, Relief Nursery, that has a record that has actually been identified and recognized nationally as this pilot program for the state. Our goal is that we can, in fact, work out the arrangements, put the blueprint in place for all of the relief nursery type of programs within the state, and then be able to actually have a model that we can take statewide. And then again, once again, the Oregon will be recognized for its innovativeness and its endeavor to actually save families and work for kids and actually save money for the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions or comments for our colleague before he goes off to his next?
Yes. That's a quick question. So please, what would happen if the family did not go to the relief nursery?
It's a referral through the DHS, and I think DHS already has programs, or let's say the framework as to how they would basically be holding the families, and I use that in a very broad term, accountable for those conducts. They could actually take action that the parents hopefully would not want, which is actually they believe it was to a level that the child is in risk, that they could actually do at least a temporary removal of the child and such.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thanks for being here.
And, thank you very much.
We have two certified smart people up here, but I'll leave it up to the audience to decide who they are.
Thanks for coming.
You bet.
Representative Nathanson, I'm going to continue with folks coming for, we have four more on this bill, and if you can stay with us, we'll be grateful. I'll have three come up now.
Perfect.
But stand by. Thank you. I'd like to ask Kelly Sutherland, Heather Murphy, and Jean Phillips to come forward if they would right away. Thank you.
I'm Kelly Sutherland, the Executive Director of Relief Nursery. Heather Murphy is on her way, and this is Jean Phelps. She's going to speak first. She's the 20-year retired director of the Relief Nursery, and she's vice chair of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. And we actually thought we were the certified smart people.
It's too late. They're going to hear us.
That's right.
About 1995. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm Jean Phelps, Wayne County. About 1995, I was invited by the International Association of Chief of Police with 100 people around the country to look at the problem of children who witness violence. Police officers were finding that they were going into homes to get involved, of course, in domestic violence situations and stop it. And what was killing them was that they'd have to turn around and leave when they would have to arrest one of the parents. And what they were leaving were children that were broken. And they tried to pretend that the children really didn't know what was going on in the families. And these police officers, mostly men, as we were working together looking at this problem, had tears going down their face, because what they couldn't do, feel comfortable about, was the fact that they were leaving situations where they knew the child was going to have lasting effects to what they had witnessed. But that wasn't their job, so they just took care of the adult. So as we were there, one of the things that happened, they were very interested in relief nurseries. They were also interested in a program that was happening in New Haven, Connecticut with Yale University and their Child Development Center. Because Yale had gone along with the, they had had a pilot project there with the police officers, and they would get a person from the Yale Child Development Center to go out with the policeman, and when the police needed to leave, they had taken care of their part. The person who stayed to take care of the child was someone from the Child Development Center and the family. And it was a wonderful, you know, the difference in how they felt and the difference that was happening to the child and the family was significant. So when I'd seen that, I thought, this is a good thing. And subsequent to that, I did a ride-along with Child Protective Services and went out to their go-outs. And it was, I'll never forget the situation. We went out with a little girl, a baby. The little girl, honest to God, was the mother. I think she was about 16. She was in a motel on a very poor area of town. She had been reported for neglect of this child, this little girl. And we went there. She was a mom who opened the door widely to a child protective officer. You know, just it was to a worker. I mean, it was she wanted help. She wasn't. She was innocent of what could be the consequences of opening her door, but she wanted help, and the caseworker was wonderful, and they talked, and subsequent to that, they closed the case. Now I'm looking around, and I'm knowing this mother, young mom, and this baby are in trouble, and this is not the last time Child Protective Services is going to hear from this mother and this baby. But the case was closed. There was no reason at this point to keep the case open. At that point, I'm thinking they need a relief nursery person in this home to take care of this family when this mother is totally motivated to get somebody in and get some help. So that was the first stirrings of this kind of program, and I'm so appreciative of Representative Nathanson and Senator Posansky for taking to bring this forward to you to get an opportunity to work with Child Protective with, and that's a big comment, Child Protective Services, so that they do their work and they do it well. And we do our work, and we do it well, but it's in a coordinated fashion. And we're not going to walk away from families when they are really most scared, most motivated to get help. We can't buy ourselves out of the problem of children being hurt. We can't. Brian Johnston, the former director of Child Protective Services from DHS, said, unless we control the numbers of children that we have coming into our system, we can never be successful with the children we serve. And I believe that. Not because they're not doing a great job. There's too many to do. We've got to keep children from being hurt. We've got to keep them out of the system, and this is what this bill allows us to start planning.
Okay.
Thank you.
I also want to thank Representative Nathanson and Senator Posansky. We're talking about 2858. You asked us to identify that. The vision, of course, is to prevent children from becoming part of the child welfare system, and this is through a collaboration between DHS and relief nurseries. What I would like to talk to you about is what we know. We know what happens when these parents don't get help. Their children are victims of abuse and neglect. We also know what happens when they do get help. The families are stabilized, the parents learn how to be good parents, the children thrive, enter school, developmentally age appropriate, and they're able to learn. They don't require special education services. And we also know that this is the time when families are most receptive to our help. They're extremely motivated when they're frightened they're going to lose their children. When there's a DHS child welfare investigation occurring, This is when they're saying, yes, help us. And this is before they become entrenched in the system, before their problems are so severe and more difficult and costly to solve. I sent this ahead of time, and it's something that's very significant and would like for you to see. You can see what happens with these families when they don't get help. There's a relatively small cost to intervene down here, but this is what happens. It's a huge price tag in human suffering and in dollars if we don't help them. Now, the most common denominator, too, for these up here, juvenile justice and criminal justice, is involvement in foster care. So that's all the more reason why we really have to prevent that from happening. Some of you are familiar with nurseries. You may have them in your communities. I know some of you would like to have them. But for those of you that are not, there are 15 nurseries across the state. We provide comprehensive services, crisis response, outreach, therapeutic early childhood classrooms, home visiting, and drug and alcohol peer support. The state of Oregon has already invested in relief nurseries. We've already been acknowledged for the good work that we do, and this project is an opportunity for you to avail yourself of our resources. Our outcomes are impressive. We stabilize these families. We address their emotional and physical developmental challenges, and we keep them out of foster care. We provided some statistical data for you from our nurseries to look at as well. To highlight, one of the most significant is after enrollment in our programs, only 2% of our children end up in foster care. Now, we also have a very long history of collaboration with DHS, which is the most significant part of this. Presently, we have an addiction recovery team contract with Lane County that's fulfilled through DHS. So we have certified drug and alcohol counselors that are actually housed at DHS, but they're relief nursery employees. They go out on first response calls when there's a child and drug and alcohol is involved in the call. So we know from experience, our experience with these families at that moment, that that is when they are most susceptible and acceptable and willing to take our help. So this pilot project with regard to this is can be the beginning of that same very successful, cost-effective collaboration between these agencies. Now, we want to track these families, and we're going to track them internally, the families that we receive the referral and we make the call. Some of these families will not accept our help. So we're going to have a natural control group. We're going to know what happens to these families because we're going to follow up with DHS and say, hey, did you go on a second and third call? And we're going to follow those families within our agency and see how successful we are. And we're going to help these families not just a little bit. We're going to provide services to the families that need the help the most and provide them a full array of our services so that we can really gauge how successful we are being. So that's why I would urge you to pass this bill and have us come back in 6 months and talk to you about our success.
Thank you for your testimony. I think Heather's joined us, so please identify yourself.
I apologize. I'm Heather Murphy, Executive Director of the Family Relief.
You're right on time.
Oh, great. Well, do I actually have some time? It was indicated that we're running a little bit behind. I can submit written testimony.
If you could hit the highlights and submit the written testimony, we'd be grateful. We have one other bill we want to hear as well.
Perfect. Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time. I'm Executive Director of the Family Relief Nursery. We reside in Cottage Grove and cover all of South Lane County. And so highlights... I think Lane County is a prime place for a pilot like this with two relief nurseries. And apologize, I was running from the parking. Anyhow, we have two relief nurseries that cover both rural and urban areas. It's a prime pilot site for. We also have very good relationships with our Lane County DHS workers and managers. Prevention is the key. We have the in-home safety and reunification service contract at our nursery for South Lane County. That is one step beyond what we're talking about here. We want to prevent kids from getting into the system, and referrals this way is a gateway for those families that are right on the cusp of entering the system. And we're a perfect resource for them, and I think this is a visionary project proposed by Representative Nathanson, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Colleagues, we have one other person to testify in opposition. Unless you've got specific questions for this panel, I'm going to move on to that. Is that all right?
Yes.
No questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. I'd like to ask Roger Williams to come forward. Identify yourself and welcome.
Co-chairs committee, thank you for having me. I'm Roger Williams. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Oregon Christian Home Education Association Network, one of the two statewide homeschooling networks. Since homeschooling is dependent on the right of parents to direct the education of their children, we are also interested in parental rights issues. To start off with, respite nurseries are wonderful. I don't know if you've done any research on your own on them, but they're a perfect place for people who, for parents who need a 2 or 3 hour break once a week to let off some pressure. They also have crisis intervention programs. we support respite nurseries. My concern about this bill is that it appears to be funneling parents who have had unsubstantiated charges of child abuse against them, funneling them into these respite nurseries, from what the good senator said, against their will in some cases. In other words, if someone is accused of child abuse, then they are considered as a prime child abuse suspect, even when there is little or no evidence for that. In fact, the bill is targeted at those parents for whom a finding of abuse is not or cannot be substantiated. I don't know if you're aware of this, but if someone upset with you phones in an anonymous tip, wants to cause trouble, maybe your ex-spouse, maybe a neighbor that doesn't like you, then DHS needs to investigate that. So an investigation is opened. And under this bill, there's no defense of innocence, of lack of evidence, as there is in other areas. You are treated as a high-risk potential child abuser. And under this concept, no parent in Oregon will be saved. None of you, not me. If my neighbor doesn't like me, I'm in the system, I'm automatically suspect and can be forced into this program. So that's our reason for opposing this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? If not, thank you for coming. Representative Nathanson, if we can, at least give an overview, and I have at least one individual that I'd like to make sure we get on the record for 2856 after you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee again. This will be about House Bill 2856, which is developed from a unanimous recommendation from the Government Efficiency Task Force, which included state, county, and local representatives. Due to the limited time, we've tried to limit the testimony to just one other person, but you will receive a packet of letters from organizations around the state in various counties, illustrating the problems and challenges that are trying to be addressed with this bill. State-funded human services are subject to multiple, often redundant, audits by various state authorities, counties, and other coordinating and funding organizations. And by audits, I'm talking about not necessarily just financial audits, but program audits, performance audits, compliance audits. There's a whole bunch of reasons why organizations are asked to do a report or an audit or whatever. Excess audits consume time and significant staff resources of not only the organization that's being audited, but by all these government agencies that are asking for the materials in more than one place. The objectives of this bill are to reduce the number and frequency of unnecessary audits required of human service providers, to establish to the greatest extent possible a uniform program for auditing or asking for reports, and to provide for the ability for abbreviated or less frequent reports for an organization that's basically always getting an A+. They're always passing they're always in compliance. Do they still need to report twice a year, once a year, year after year after year? Or is there an abbreviated type of review without compromising safety and appropriate oversight? This bill would require Department of Human Services to create a pilot program and to report the findings to the 77th Legislative Assembly. Following up on open and candid discussions with DHS staff, my office is working on an amendment, or maybe more than one amendment, to make sure that we provide DHS the flexibility to work on the type of audits, basically where you can get the best bang for the buck. The department has been making strides in recent time, in the past year or so, in reducing administrative burdens and other system processes. Their new initiatives toward continuous improvement are laudable. They obviously have a lot of work to do. It's a huge department. I started to say it's like an elephant, then I realized it's really more like an octopus because there are so many different pieces of DHS that are touching each one of these organizations that are providing services. The bill is asking DHS to focus on one kind of administrative burden, all this reporting and auditing that's going on. Without compromising oversight, I think we can reduce costs for the providers, for the local governments, and for the state as well, who's processing all this paperwork that's going across multiple desks. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions for Representative Nathanson at this point? No. I'd like to ask Janet Ahrens, and I'll ask the others to hold for the moment, and we'll get Ms. Ahrens' testimony first.
Good morning. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. We're distributing those packets for you now. My name is Janet Ahrens. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. And in that packet, you'll see some notes or some testimony from me. I'm just going to do a couple of brief highlights from that because you'll be able to read it. Also attached to that are a number of letters from nonprofit providers around the state that speak to their support for the bill and also offer some suggestions for places to start or places to consider. The Alliance of Children's Programs represents $180 million worth of services and small business in Oregon, 7,000 employees, 95,000 children. We address a broad array of kinds of services in our organization. So we do everything from Healthy Start to high-end psychiatric residential facilities. That includes runaway and homeless, kids with developmental disabilities, mental health, addiction services, child welfare, foster care, juvenile justice. So we have a really terrific overview and perspective when looking at opportunities to, and all are licensed through DHS, so we all have a perspective to be able to look at the impact across county relationships and other state agency relationships that administrative rules, audits, and this kind of oversight can have. Just to go quickly, there are sort of two main pieces to the testimony. One is, what is the impact on providers? And you'll see that Morrison Child and Family Services in Portland, they have to employ 7 full-time employees just to be able to respond to all of the oversight issues that they have to address. That's over $300,000 a year in payroll costs to be able to do that. The next door in Hood River devotes a minimum of 720 hours every year to dealing with staffing for audits and reports. And the in-home in Clackamas County has a $300,000 program that had 6 reviews in 12 months. You'll see when you turn that page over that there's a number of other examples of impacts on providers. The also provided here is a sampling of suggestions for streamlining for cost savings. And I want to emphasize that first bullet because the theme here for the provider mission and perspective is to direct ever-shrinking fiscal resources to client care and not to overly burdensome administrative reviews. And you'll see in here a number of bullets of suggestions of ideas. We can go to low-hanging fruit where in audits and reviews the state would accept electronic records instead of having people stand over Xerox machines, or we could burn a disk and hand it to every state agency who is interested in looking at the same kinds of documents over and over again. And in terms of trying to, and Representative Nathanson made a good point. It's a big agency. There's, as I understand it, over 250 different entities licensed through child welfare. And so how do they take on a task like this? And we would suggest that they take a look first and prioritize those that affect the most providers and also those which can have the greatest fiscal impact, returning, again, that theme of shrinking resources back into services and direct contact with children.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions at all?
Mr. Chair, could I just make a statement? Last session, please. I don't think anybody here was on the Human Services Committee except me, and we had hours of testimony about the duplication of services with these audits. I mean, Morrison City, 44 requests for audits. They just duplicate and overlap, and they ask for information in different ways. So this is an excellent idea. This is an issue whose time has come. We need to be doing this. People should be providing services. to the children involved and not just providing audits or responses to audits to different agencies. So thank you for doing this. Thanks to Representative Nathanson for doing this. And we have a lot of work ahead of us on this.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. With your permission, Representative Nathanson, we're going to hold over both these bills because I feel like there's enough, particularly on this one, 2856, there are enough folks, and I hope they're all local, that can come back and finish our testimony, and some issues left, including amendments on the other bill, that we should hold both over. Is that all right with you? So it is our intention to hold over House Bills 2858 and 2856 for the next meeting, and with that I will close the public hearing on 2858 and on 2856. Colleagues, we have a number of folks in the room and probably still coming for our next item. This is not a bill, but rather an informational hearing on a subject that I think is extremely important to each and every one of us. So with that, I am going to open a public hearing on what we're calling community partnerships and nonprofits. So that public hearing, informational hearing, is now open, and I'm going to ask the first three to come up, and while they come up, I want to talk a little bit about how the morning, we see the morning going. So if Carrie Hoops, Dixon Bledsoe, and Michael Rideout are in the room, I'd love for them to come on up. And colleagues, I hope you'll stick with me. We've got a number of people that have indicated that they would like to speak. We've got a number that, even as late as this morning, have said so. If you're not already on the list, folks, I want you to have the opportunity if we have time, but I hope that you'll be patient with me, and I hope that my colleagues will be patient with me. We're on the floor at 11, and I'd like us to at least go for a couple of hours here, and as many that can stay according to your schedule, I'll be grateful.
Yeah, I need to leave a little early.
I understand, Representative Greenlee, but thank you for being here for as long as you can. There was a great article about this very subject in the Oregonian, and so I became intrigued with the Nonprofit Association of Oregon, and I was pleased to at least talk on the phone with their executive director, Carrie Hoops, but we haven't met.
Hello.
I want you to go first because I hope you can give us an overview of what's happening in this field of our nonprofit community and how it melds with what the state has to do and with all of us in our district. So welcome, identify yourself, and we're glad you're here.
I could ask Matt Davis to put the PowerPoint up. Thank you, Co-Chairs Tomei and Representative Gilliam and other committee members for including us today. We're really excited at this opportunity. My name is Carrie Hoops. I'm the Executive Director of the Nonprofit Association of Oregon. With me today is my Vice President of our Board of Directors, Rick Nitti. He's also the Executive Director of the Neighborhood House, which is a 106-year-old social service organization. We were asked to give a brief presentation today. As Representative Gilliam said, there was an article in the Oregonian Metro Section two Sundays ago that featured the economic impact of the nonprofit community in the state of Oregon. We were told we have about 10 minutes, so I'm going to quickly move through these slides, and Rick and I will do-si-do back and forth. So starting with our core services, the Nonprofit Association of Oregon does training and convening. We produce 75 to 100 trainings per year around the state. We have 7 nonprofit networks that meet in Portland, Salem, Medford, Bend. We also do workshops in Eugene. We have an executive transition services program where we place interim executive directors and nonprofits experiencing leadership changes. We're also moving into interim finance managers and development directors. We've been doing consulting for the nonprofit community over 30 years, things like strategic planning, leadership development, executive coaching, group facilitation. We have lots of information and resources for the nonprofit sector, including a monthly e-news that we produce that provides tips for the sector on how they can tap into the latest nonprofit trends. In terms of public policy and advocacy, we're in the infancy stage of this work. We have alerts that let folks know about the local and national legislative initiatives that are going on and that impact the nonprofit sector. And then we have a host of member benefits and discounts for the sector, including things like unemployment insurance, discounts on background checks, low-cost credit card processing. And I brought packets of information if there's anybody in the room that would like information.
We've served over 8,000.
And if you would identify yourself just for the record.
Yes. My name is Rick Nitti. I'm the Executive Director of Neighborhood House in Portland, Oregon.
Thank
and
you.
Vice President of NAO. So we've served over 8,000 individuals. This includes nonprofit administrators, board members, development directors, fiscal officers, volunteers, and people interested in starting nonprofit organizations. We've served over 3,500 nonprofit organizations across the state of Oregon. Most individuals and nonprofits served participated in one of our 100 training sessions or got the information, resources, and referrals they needed through our nonprofit helpline. Our consulting team worked with approximately 400 nonprofit organizations last year, including nonprofits involved in cohort programs that build organizational and leadership capacity. Each month, we sell roughly 10 copies of the Oregon Nonprofit Corporation Handbook, an essential resource for nonprofit managers in the state.
In terms of the nonprofit sector and types of organizations in our state, there's over 22,000 registered nonprofits in Oregon. These include the 501c3s, private foundations, and other, for example, C4s, C6s, and professional organizations. Over 67% are public charities, and many of the human services providers that you're going to hear from today in the testimony are also public charities.
Oregonians think very highly of their nonprofits. In a 2005 public opinion poll over 1,700 Oregonians, they found 70% said nonprofits play an important role in making their communities a better place to live. 70% said they or a member of their household participated in one or was helped by a nonprofit in the past 2 years. 79% said their involvement with nonprofits improved the quality of their lives.
Let's get back. In terms of the nonprofit sector and top areas of focus, nonprofits provide a wide variety of services in our communities. And this is a slide that breaks down the different areas. There's 70% in education, 14% in arts, culture, and humanities, 10% human services, 10% sports, recreation, and leisure, 6% community improvement, 5% are religious, and 5% environmental protection.
Nonprofits offer meaningful avenues for civic engagement through volunteerism. Over 35% of all Oregonians volunteer, one of the highest rates of volunteerism in the U.S. This is something we can all be very proud of.
So I'm skipping around here. A little known fact is that Oregon nonprofits employ over 160,000 people, and this represents 12% of all private sector jobs in Oregon. Sorry, we're skipping around here. Next up is a slide on our members. We currently have 425 nonprofit members and 120 affiliate members. Our nonprofit members are small, medium, and large organizations. The bulk of them have budgets under $100,000. So last slide I wanted to hit on was our strategic vision. So for over 30 years, we were the organization known as TACS, Technical Assistance for Community Service, founded by Kay Soule, who also produces the handbook that we distribute. 2 years ago, the board of directors went through a strategic planning process, and we changed our identity to the Nonprofit Association of Oregon. Why? To work towards a stronger, more unified nonprofit sector, become the trusted voice of the sector, create positive legislative outcomes, have greater visibility of the role of nonprofits in keeping our communities strong and vibrant. And we're really looking forward to meeting with nonprofits across our state in a series of quarterly town hall listening sessions. We've done two already, one in Portland, one in Eugene. We've got three more events booked, one in April in Bend, going to Medford in May, and Pendleton in June. Sort of sussing out what are the top challenges the nonprofit sector is facing, how can we help as the state association and this new entity to provide services and do the best types of training we can. So in concluding, we want to thank you for inviting us here today. It's a big step for us to be able to partner with, you know, other nonprofits and the good works that they're doing. We hope that you will reach out to the other nonprofits that all of you are working with and encourage them to take advantage of our programs and services, to get connected and to get involved involved in this important advocacy work. For our sector to stay strong and help make our communities great places to live, we need to stick together. We need to have a strong statewide voice for the nonprofit sector. We need to share ideas and resources. We need to collaborate whenever and wherever possible. And we need to have our voices heard around the public policymaking tables. We need to elevate the good works of Oregon nonprofits with opinion leaders and the media. And we need to do this together as a sector. So thanks so much.
Thank you. And before I ask colleagues for questions, I want to say how much I appreciate you're coming here and giving the presentation, and I want to pick up on what you said at the end about together. I'm grateful to my co-chair for cooperating with me on this hearing today. And one thing we've talked about, this is not in any way us against them.
Right.
There's only one group, I think, that knows more about the seriousness of human misery in human services right now in Oregon, more than the Department of Human Services, and that's the nonprofits, particularly those that are in your group that are serving. So we have been hearing testimony and informational backgrounds about how tough things are. And if you go through their testimony, you'll find we are already, the department in many ways is reaching out to the nonprofit community. I simply want to see more of that. And I think as times get tougher and budgets get tighter and need gets greater, we need to talk. So this is what this is about today, is hopefully continue with that conversation so that the department knows who's out there, the folks in this room know more about the department, and together we can meet more needs. So if there are any questions, for please, Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is kind of a thought or possibly an idea with you. There's a few of us members here that actually sit on human services and health care. And one of the big issues that we deal with a lot is mental health issues. And we have groups like AA that are out there helping with the Alcoholics Anonymous and different groups like that. And it'd be nice to see the nonprofits, because I know you can do it better than we can. AA is a prime example. But to look at cultivating that kind of community for some of the mental patients that are dealing with mental illness, because when you're sitting there listening to someone talk to you and they're getting paid to hear your problems, it doesn't mean as much as when you come see me because you care about me and you volunteered because you want to see me get better. That's what means something. And you guys can do it better than we can do it at the state, no matter what we do here. So I just kind of want to throw that out in your outreach, because there's groups out there like Stevens Ministers that do things like this, and start cultivating that for helping some of our mental patients that we have in the state. So that is my statement and an idea for you, because I know no matter what we do, it's not going to be as good as what you can do. So, because your people are there for the right reasons.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Green.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I not only serve on those two committees, but also sit on the Ways and Means Subcommittee, and I'm staring at budgets that will cut huge amounts of money to the nonprofits. In fact, the way the state does business is giving you the money basically to do it. I wonder if you have a sense of what proportion of the budgets of your agencies come from state funds. And I'll ask, I would hope other of you who will be testifying today can comment on the extent to which your programs are basically funded by state funds.
We don't have that data. I don't know if
I don't have that data either. And our membership ranges, or nonprofit community ranges, from zero to probably 80-90%. So it's a big range. I know my organization has about 20%, 25% comes from state dollars.
It's a great question, because it's a very complicated system. Yeah. And our nonprofits not only utilize state dollars, but federal dollars, along with their private fundraising. And you're good.
Yeah.
You're good
to it's probably important to realize that, particularly in the social services world, nonprofits are a critical partner with government, and it goes both ways. And organizations that are serving the poor, the mentally ill, are highly dependent on getting support from local governments, from the state, and from the federal government.
Great.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. We hope you can stay. Thank you for coming down. Stay as long as
you'd
like.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
Dixon, just hold And I'm going to ask Michael Wright. Is Michael in the room? Michael, yeah, Michael. And I'm going to ask Gretchen Bennett to come forward. And if I don't see Gretchen.
She's right here.
Oh, sorry. And colleagues, you're going to see, it's just total coincidence, you're going to see a couple people from Silverton up here today.
Oh. How'd that happen?
I don't know. And one of my favorites is here, so I'm just going to say that right off the bat. Now, we don't use acronyms here, but I got to tell you, Madam Chair, if you say SACA in Silverton, people know what you're talking about. Silverton Area Community Aid. And Dixon, identify yourself and kick us off.
My name is Dixon Bledsoe. I'm Executive Director of Silverton Area Community Aid, as Representative Gilliam just mentioned. It's called SACA. We're a private nonprofit. We have operating a budget of about $325,000 a year. Of that, a lot of that is non-financial aid in the form of food donations. About $170,000 is in donations. We receive no state funding. I put in for a $10,000 FEMA grant last year and got it and was notified we probably have a really good chance of not getting it this year, so I'm not banking on that. So other than that, it's all private donations. We are the area's food bank. We serve about 23,000 people, which comprises of the Silver Falls School District area. We help about 14,000 people a year in a variety of capacities. One is food. Obviously, we're the local food bank. The second is we help with rent for people that are being evicted. We also help with prescriptions. We help with utilities. We also help with firewood, as Representative Gilliam knows full well. He's helped with our firewood crew, and he does an admirable job. I might rehire him next year. Our mission really is to help people in emergency situations. I am excited about the job because what we do is we have people come in every day that need help in some variety of fashion, whether it's a referral to an agency or a nonprofit that might be able to help them, or to a local dentist who might be able to help with dental care on a sliding scale or a no basis. What we do is food and emergency assistance, and our philosophy is pretty simple. If you present to us with an eviction notice from your landlord, if there's a way that we can help, we're going to figure out how to do it. We require an eviction notice. We go through the whole process of screening for what income people have, how they got into that position. I have been known, when somebody presents to me with a $75 water bill and their water is being shut off, I have been known to ask in a delicate way why the $300 BlackBerry instead of the $75 water bill. I think it's a key point in social services to be able to do what I call, if you don't have case management, as we don't, to do curbside case management, to be able to ask people, how are you planning on, if I give you a check for $700 today to stay in your apartment for one more month, what's your plan for the following month? When I first started, we were excited about community action because they come in and out of various forms of funding, and they're able to help with housing at some point. We've been shut off for housing since last July. On January 4th of 2010, I spent January's budget for rent. By June, we had used the year's allotment, so our board, which is a very fiscally conservative, very, very, very sound board that does a great job reserving funds, we said, okay, we have to make the tough decision. Do we help people with heat and water? What can we do about housing? We put in for a community grant from Spirit Mountain. We have a chance of getting that. We get a $20,000 United Way grant, which will probably be reduced this year because the new year and new grants are due for a July 1st start. But we're targeting our fundraising specifically to rent into emergency utility assistance. One of the things that I've implemented is restricting people that have hit a certain earmark or a certain target of $2,000 over the course of 2 years. And it's tough to say, but if somebody has come in on a regular basis, we also do gas vouchers as well to get to job interviews and health-related appointments. So if somebody has used us real frequently, it goes beyond an emergency assistance and more into a maintenance assistance. And my philosophy is, and our board philosophy is, I don't want to cut out people who have never used us in favor of people that use us all the time. It'd be great to help everybody, but we're not in that luxurious position. So we are looking at grant money. We are looking at different types of fundraisers to get more money for rent. And our philosophy on rent is pretty simple. We have two people that present to us. One is they need help for that particular month because of a medical bill, a lost job before they're able to get on unemployment or something to that degree. So they need a help up for a month. The second group are people who are really, how can I put this? The second group are people that really the numbers are not there for them. They're going to struggle and they're going to need some help beyond that. So we provide some case management, but we're going to give them, if we can, a check for rent to buy them 30 days of staying in their home so they can get their affairs in order. They may need to move to a shelter. They may need to move in with relatives or friends or something, but the numbers just aren't there. When I talk with them, you know, we do a screening at the front desk, and then people that have unique situations will come in back and talk to me. So I'll spend a lot of time talking to them about the numbers and what's your plan after this month. So I might be able to buy you 30 days of staying in your house or another 30 days of heat or water or sewer, any of that. But after that, we're one-time financial assistance. And so it's tough, but it's a tremendous organization, incredible community support in Silverton. And since you asked me here to come and talk today, how may I be of help to you? Do you have any questions for me?
I'm going to hold questions. If you'll just hold each panel, I'll have present their organization, then we'll have a brief time for questions and move to the next. So, Michael, go right ahead.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I would just like to thank you for the opportunity to share with you about what we're doing in the local community here.
And
I'm Mike Rideout.
Yep, thank you.
President and CEO of the Union Gospel Mission of Salem. And since I know you're on a tight schedule, I've got a prepared statement, then be more than happy to take questions.
Thank you.
The Union Gospel Mission of Salem has been serving the Marion and Polk County communities since 1953. And over the years, our services and programs have increased, but our goal has always remained the same, reaching out to the hungry, hurting, homeless men, women, and children, demonstrating God's love by meeting their physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual needs. Our desire is to help men and women break the cycle of homelessness and become participating members of our community by providing some of the following: meals, shelter, assessment and referral services to homeless men, women, and children, recovery programs to overcome addictions and other life-controlling behaviors, educational and job readiness programs to help men and women re-enter the workforce through our Valley Employment and Career Services Department, outreach programs that provide free clothing, furniture, financial counseling, spiritual guidance, and referral services to low-income families that may be struggling and on the verge of homelessness, and a free dental clinic offering services to men, women, and children that are living in our facilities, affordable and safe housing for program graduates transitioning back into the workforce. These are a few of the current service statistics being provided at our five facilities with our staff of 60 employees and over 400 community volunteers. We're providing 165,000 meals a year, up to 90,000 nights of safe shelter. We're distributing 4,500 personal hygiene kits and providing 47,000 showers to homeless men and women. We're doing over 7,000 loads of laundry for guests staying with us. We're providing 6,500 hours of individual counseling. We're providing over 8,000 hours of addiction recovery classes, 6,000 hours of instruction in our adult learning centers, and we're distributing nearly $150,000 of free clothing, furniture, through our outreach ministry to needy individuals and families in our community. Over 100 men and women will participate in our long-term recovery program each year, and over 400 volunteers will provide nearly 30,000 hours of volunteer service worth over $500,000. 95% of our annual operating budget of $5 million comes from 20,000 individual donors in our community. The remaining 5% comes from churches, foundations, and corporations. All of our services and programs are provided free of charge at no cost to the government or the taxpayer. We are always looking for ways to partner with other agencies in the community in order to reach more people in need, use limited resources efficiently, and most importantly, enhance our effectiveness to those we serve. Our goal today is the same as it has always been since 1953, compassionately reaching out to the most needy in our community, restoring hope and restoring lives.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. Gretchen, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gretchen Bennett, and I'm honored to serve as the executive director of Liberty House. I guess I can't move that. I'm sorry. You know, I was thinking about your committee meeting today, and one of the things that I wanted to tell you is that I don't think we could have started without you, and I don't think we can do the work without you, you being the proverbial state, if you will. We opened our doors in 1999, and public and private partners wanted a better way to respond to concerns of child abuse and neglect. And at that time, we were virtually completely funded by state dollars, specifically the dollars that come through the criminal fines and assessment account, the fees and fines that are assessed to people who commit crimes in the system. Today, that dollar amount has reduced to about 40% of our overall budget. It remains, obviously, a core component. Not only budgetarily, but philosophically, people talk about the logic. People who love Liberty House talk about the logic between the dollars that criminals pay into the court system going to cover some of the costs that the crime incurs. And so assessment of child victims would be an example of that type of cost. I was thinking that about all of the roles that we all play, and my public partners tell me that our service is a unique component within our multidisciplinary team. We work closely with child welfare and with police organizations in the understanding of what's happening when there's a concern of abuse or neglect. And so we're providing something that's unique and also not provided elsewhere in the community by other types of organizations. It's a unique service that we provide at the Child Abuse Assessment Center. Regional centers, I would also offer, are unique because they provide, those organizations around Oregon provide specialty training to us and peer review that allow us to achieve the quality assurance that's necessary to be sure we're doing a good job with these assessments. We've dealt with a 35% increase in assessments for concerns of physical abuse. The passage of Carley's Law in the 2007 legislative session set up some specific requirements for how we respond to children with abuse concerns, which I think has changed the response for that. And I just don't know how we can do it without state dollars and without that public-private partnership. I was reflecting on the meeting today and thinking about, I'm proud of the fact that we've increased our community contributions so much. Like I said, going from virtually 100% state criminal fines dollars funding Liberty House to today being at about 40%. But donors leave me for lots of reasons. I think largely when we're successful, we increase private support. But I also think it's true that I've had donors call me in tears and say they can't make that monthly contribution anymore because they've lost their job or business industry factors are changing for them. And so there's other factors that go into people contributing to Liberty House. And when I have people in the public safety sector articulating for me the importance of our contribution to a good child abuse assessment, I think it's such an essential component that I would hate for the winds and the seas of factors outside my control to influence whether I can say yes or no to a child. So I guess that's what I wanted to offer today. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. And colleagues, you know, to Representative Greenlick's point, what an interesting set of models here of how the state comes into a play. There are no state dollars and a mix in Dixon's case. Are there any questions? Yes, Representative.
Well, first of all, I think more comment for me than anything. I am way appreciative of the fact that this room is as full as it is today, and with the diversity of the three of you on the panel and what you are all doing and how different it is and how it fits a piece of the puzzle of solving some of the human service issue is just tremendous to me. One of the questions I have, though, is, you know, certainly the economy has put a lot of folks into your purview and folks who you might not have never seen, and maybe your donors who used to be donors and now we're seeing that at the food bank in my own community right now. Folks who used to bring stuff in are now looking for that handout. How much of what you're seeing is, you know, right now is the economy, and how much of it do you think is like truly chronic? Folks who are, you know, kind of habitually, permanently, multi-generationally in the system. That's some data that I'd like to know if you guys are, those are the things you're tracking.
Well, I could speak to that a little bit. I think for a lot of men and women that come to us, that's their choice of last resort, and they are chronically homeless or struggling for years with drug and alcohol issues, in and out of jail or prison. So we are seeing somewhat of a chronic population, I guess a more difficult population to deal with. That said, we do see a 25 to 30% increase in meals that we're serving and beds that we're providing in our shelters from last fall. Some of that's seasonal. We always see numbers go up as it gets colder and wetter outside. But we are seeing, again, it's hard to track specifically, but we know, especially there's men in our shelter that lost their job and are really struggling. So they're in the shelter and they're out working part-time trying to make ends meet. And then on the opposite side, we've had many, many donors that have, you know, told us that we were going to have to reduce our contribution or we just can't give right now. When the economy immediately took its downturn, that first year we probably saw a loss of about $400,000 to $500,000 in revenue, which is big. We were able to get through that without decreasing any services. We just made some adjustments. I only had to do two layoffs. I don't want to do any, but it was just reality. But we've been able to keep up with the service requests.
I'll usually I'm pretty shy, so but I'll go ahead and use.
Yeah, I know that about you.
Thank you very much. I would say we have two different categories. One is food, the chronic requests for food. Financial assistance is probably, I would say, about 10 to 12% are chronic users of our financial system. But keep in mind, we only allow a $300 cap, for example, for financial assistance beyond rent, for utilities, prescriptions, gas vouchers, and things like that. So it's one time a year. And we're doing some real good analysis on people that are chronic users over the course of a 3 or 4 year period. Probably 80% of the people that come in are regular users of our food distribution. And the primary reason for that is continued unemployment or fixed income. When you have somebody that's paying $800 a month in rent and they get a $600 Social Security check, it's not rocket science to be able to figure out that they're going to be coming in regularly. And we have a lot of food. We get some tremendous donations. We work food drives. We do a good job getting food in. So chronic use of food is okay with us. The financial is where we get more strict. I had somebody at a service club that I talked to a few weeks ago. They said, well, how do you know that people aren't abusing the system? And I said, well, one thing is if somebody comes in and asks us for food, my belief is they probably need it. I don't think they're going to black market it because they might get, you know, a little bit of money on the black market, but I don't think that's going to happen. So I said, if somebody comes in and asks us for food on a regular basis, we're probably going to provide it. And if they're cheating or they're not telling me the truth, I'm still going to sleep okay. And I would say probably on the food part, 3 to 5% maybe are chronic abusers of the system, and we keep a careful eye on those. We don't turn too many people down for a bag of food. We have people that present from Salem and outlying areas outside of the Silverton School District, which we serve, and if I give them a bag of food and tell them where the closest food bank is to their district, I'm good with that. So we have pretty tight numbers.
In child abuse, my impression of the literature is that there's a lot of macro forces that contribute, and there are lots of categories of abuse that are not affected by economic factors. But certainly, I think overall, there's concern that if there's a lack of protective factors surrounding a family, there would be a correlation to drug and alcohol or meth addiction, and then you see abuse as a consequence of some of those actions. And I have read one study that suggests that if you have a family with a mother and a boyfriend and children, and the boyfriend is out of work and the primary caretaker for children, not by choice or intention, you'll see a correlation to some physical abuse there. But largely, I think it's important to recognize that there's abuse existing independently of socioeconomic factors as well. On the donation side, I think largely the trend would be that we've seen an increase in numbers of contributors contributing at lesser amounts.
Thank you. Colleagues, we're going to move on. Thank you very much for your testimony and for your missions and what you're doing. I'm going to ask our next panel, how many are in the room from Polk County Commission for Children and Family Services? Is it one? All right, would that commission come up? Anybody that's associated with the commission come up? And I'm going to have to limit you to 5 minutes, so split it up any way you want. But we're glad you're here, and if you want to comment on the quality of your representation in the legislature, you're welcome to do so.
The representation is excellent.
That won't be necessary. That's done frequently in the community.
Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brent DeMo. I'm the manager for the Polk County Commission for Children and Families.
And my name is Dave Guile. I'm actually a program evaluator. I have my own business, and I've just completed an evaluation of the Polk County service integration model. And they deal a lot with nonprofits, and they've asked me to give you some information about how that system works together. And I think it fits in exactly with what you're talking about this morning. Essentially, the Polk County Service Integration Model represents 103 community partners, and those partners are 65% nonprofit or private business, 35% are governmental agencies. And you've got a handout coming around that tells you a little bit about what happens in Polk County, so I'm just going to kind of walk you through that. Essentially, across the top there, if you look, there are 18 words that describe what happens in Polk County for service integration. It really is community and agency partners divided up into six teams. And those six teams, there's one team for each of the six school districts in Polk County. They meet monthly, but they work together daily to resolve problems. And some of those members include ministerial associations, the Grand Ronde tribal community, the Chamber of Commerce, there are private businesses, and a number of nonprofits, and of course some public agencies. The goal for each team is to expedite solutions by matching resources to clearly identified needs, and they're very, very specific about this. That chart on the front of the handout there shows you the kinds of needs that came to those service integration teams in 2010 and what percent of the dollars that they had available to them went for each of those different categories. They're very, very local interventions because Polk County in those six regions have differing needs. The needs in West Salem are quite different than what happens out in Perrydale, and I think Chairman Gilliam, you would recognize a similar kind of thing in the geographic area that you represent. There is rural, and then there's a more urban feel to parts of the county, so the needs are very different. The other thing that these teams really try to do is avoid any duplication of services, so they're very efficient and very effective in doing that. On the back, I've listed on there some of the key findings that came out of my evaluation from Polk County. I'll just highlight a few of those. One of the things that Polk County had done was started recording interventions or integration activities between two or more partners. I could find written evidence of 490 of those collaborations in 2010. However, through interviews with the constituents and with the partners, I found out that the actual number was probably between 1,500 and 2,000, and that's one of the refinements that they're making now for 2011. They've also developed a process now to record all the financial activities and how those dollars get leveraged. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. The good news for 2010 is that 48% of the requests that came in were handled without any public funds. The nonprofit stepped up or a private business stepped up. For example, there was a family that had had their tires slashed on their car, and they needed that car to get to and from work. That request came to one of those service integration team meetings, and one of the partners stepped up and just funded that. There was no cost, no public taxpayer cost to that solution. The meetings to coordinate this work are also very efficient. They take 1.1% of the paid public staff time to attend those meetings. So if they go to all six meetings, 7% of their time is spent in meetings, which, as you know from the time you spend in meetings, your time is very valuable and so is theirs, and that's very efficient use of time. That 1% of time translates into $215 worth of solutions. So again, very good efficiency. They did have a multiplier effect that I could calculate on the expenditure of funds. They had $28,000 to spend, and that resulted in $129,000 worth of service. So excellent use of their resources. You've heard already from some of the other presenters, and I'm sure you'll continue to hear it, that efficiency and effectiveness are crucial, as is adequacy. Can these organizations and the way they operate meet the needs that are coming before them? What's beautiful in Polk County is that Ahern three partners, they would fill this room, sit down together monthly, and actually do that right now. And they do that in a very effective way. Service integration has been going on for 17 years in Polk County, so this isn't new. What they're doing, though, is refining their process a little bit to better track exactly what's happening, make sure they know exactly where all the dollars went and how those services got delivered to the constituents that need them. With that, we thank you very much for your time, and I think I stayed within 5 minutes.
You were really close, and I appreciate it. And I'm glad for a spotlight on one of our Commission for Children and Families. I'm proud of mine in Marion County as well, and I'm pleased to know what the good work in Polk County. A Polk County question, really small. Yeah, I like that.
As the representative from northern rural Polk County in Perrydale, I appreciate you being here for me today, and I thank you for thinking I'm doing a wonderful job for you. So.
As a graduate of Perrydale, you're welcome.
Yeah.
Can interpret that.
My younger brother was a graduate of Perrydale as well.
Well, we could take all day on that.
Anyway,
thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And
I'd
like to call Dan Aberg, Marshall Leslie, and Lynn Saxton up. Are they all here in the room?
Mr. Chair, could I say something while they're coming
up?
Thank you. I just want to point out it was wonderful that we had somebody from the Commission for Children and Families, because through the almost 11 years that I've been on this committee, we have heard consistently from the commissions in the various counties on what great work would they do and how they leverage funds that the state is able to give them to provide many more services than we could have provided on our own. So thank you so much for coming from the commission. If anybody else is here from the commissions, we look forward to hearing from you.
Well said, and I'm glad you said that. So please, Dan, if you'll kick us off on this panel, and we'll have questions at the end.
Thank you. Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Tomei, and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to be here today. My name is Dan Aberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Tualatin Valley Workshop.
Dan, I've done this before, too. Just back off on that microphone or push it away a little bit. We get a little bit of feedback. There you
okay.
go. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Is that better?
Yep.
Okay. We're located in Hillsboro. And to understand some of our community partnerships and things we do, I need to give you a little bit about what our structure is and what we do. We have what we do is we serve a clientele of adults with developmental disabilities. We have three divisions. We have a janitorial, which kind of speaks for itself on what it does. We have a workshop, job development, job training program, and something called Alternative to Employment, or ATE, probably better known as daytime activities for those people who cannot work. I'm going to speak to the last two. Our worksite development, we take the individuals who come to us and we train them. We put them to work, and we go out and get a contract with private industry to do jobs for them. They might be shrink wrapping. For example, if you've ever been in Costco and wanted to get a jar of pickles, you can't. You have to have two. Blame us. We do that. Other packaging, sorting, envelope stuffing. One of the private businesses in the Beaverton area is Leupold and Stevens. We do all their catalog mailings, which is over 100,000 mailings a year. Another one, if you go into a store and buy a jacket and you have those tags that kind of hang down and get in your way, we process those. As a matter of fact, last year we did over 1.25 million of those tags, and there's like five to the bunch. Those are just some of the things that we do. Some of the problems that the people have, and what might be Down syndrome, Asperger's, autism, and a host of other challenges. The other thing we do is the alternative to employment or daytime activities, and this is the one I'm kind of going to hone in on. We have 65 people that come to that particular program on a daily basis. We do a lot of community inclusion, and that would be we take them bowling, we take them to the movies, we take them to the library, we take them to the dollar store, we take them to Fred Meyer's, and get them out in the community so the community becomes more aware of who these people are and what they can bring to the table. Our funding from the state is 30% of our budget, and unfortunately in the budget as it stands today, the ATE funds or community activities have been wiped out completely. This affects 2,000 people statewide for a savings of $6 million. Now, $6 million is a lot of money to me, but in the realm of $3.2 billion, it's not a whole lot of money. And I think that by doing that, you're going to create a lot of problems. You're going to reduce the quality of life of these 2,000 people considerably. Over half our people came from the state hospitals, and it took us a long time to be able to work on their behavior problems and get them to a place where they now enjoy life, they enjoy being there, they love the sociability, they love their outings.
Mr. Chair, can I comment on that, please?
Please.
This is a very important issue, and it's one that we're hearing in the Ways and Means Subcommittee, and I think anything any of you do to help talk to the folks that are key decision makers in the Ways and Means. It's in the governor's balanced budget that this is going to.
That's correct.
Not in the co-chair's budget. I think destroying that program would just be a tragedy. So,
thank you, thank you, Representative Greenlake. I couldn't agree more. What it does for my organization is I have to lay off 15 people. I still have a lot of costs. I have buildings and rent and copier leases and et cetera. And even if in 2 years from now or 4 years from now the budget comes back and you say, oh, you guys can start this program, I don't have a site, I certainly don't have a qualified staff, I'll have to start from zero. I think you're kicking the can down the street for these individuals. So I'll leave it at that. Oh, one other thing, because Representative Wiedner mentioned it. A lot of our people have other problems besides a developmental disability. They may have bipolarism. They may have schizophrenia. They might have paranoia. There is a huge lack of professionals who are willing to treat people of this of these afflictions that have both the disability and the other mental problems. It is very, very difficult to find someone who will help them.
Thank you.
It's a shame.
Thank you, and forgive me, but we got to keep moving. Lynn, glad you're here.
Co-Chair Gilliam, representatives, my name is Lynn Saxton. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Christie Care, and it's my pleasure and privilege to be here with you all today. You have quite a challenging task before you, and I have tremendous respect for your willingness to take it on. Christy Care is perhaps Oregon's oldest charity. We are 151 years old. We began our mission serving children whose parents had died coming on the Oregon Trail. Our more recent mission in the last 50 years is serving acutely mentally ill children from all 36 counties in the state and their families. A few high points, and then happy to answer questions. In America today, in this state, one in five children have a serious emotional disorder, and that statistic should be a little sobering for all of us. That's 20% of the population, regardless of socioeconomic position. We serve those children's needs in a variety of formats, residential care, in-home services, which we are beginning in Washington and Clackamas County this month, and a number of public-private partnerships, including one with the Clackamas Education Service District, where we serve acutely mentally ill children in a classroom setting so that their academic pursuits can stay on track. We offer several entirely privately funded programs, including equine-assisted psychotherapy and a challenge ropes course. We employ, on average, 270 Oregonians every day. That's on average. We have an annual payroll of $6 million. We have an operating budget of $10 million. We provide support to state-funded services to the level of about 20% a year. So we fundraise between $1.5 and $2 million a year directly supporting services to children and families. And we pay about $400,000 in federal taxes annually. So with that, I'm going to be concise, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for that concise but wonderful summation of your mission and what you do. Any questions so far?
The only thing I have not been able to figure out is if you fall in Representative Garrett's district or if you fall in my district, because the line runs right through Merrillhurst. So.
We have programs throughout Clackamas, so we're probably in both your districts. And, of course, we serve children in all 36 counties. I did forget to mention, it's important to note because it's a distinction for Oregon currently, is we have the country's first Native American program for acutely mentally ill children. So we also serve the 9 federally recognized tribes in addition to the counties.
What kind of volunteer programs do you have with Christy Care?
We have a number of volunteer programs, and basically what we like to do is create an opportunity for people to volunteer to their strengths. So we have a number of corporate partners who send out teams of 30 or 40 people who work on our 3 locations, which are in Oregon City, Redland, and Merrillhurst. So they'll do painting, they'll do landscape work, they'll do a lot of physical work. We also have mentors who work directly with our clients because of the HIPAA requirements and the state's requirements for safety of these children. Those volunteers have to go through pretty much the same level of rigor as our employees. So they have to go through a criminal background check. They have to be specially trained to work with the mentally ill, et cetera. So we also have those employees. And then we have a number of those volunteers. Then we have a number of volunteers who contribute from senior citizens who work in our academic settings to improve reading skills with our children and our youth. We serve up to age 24, and we have volunteers who like to specifically work on events or fundraising activities such as walks, or we do a luncheon every year focusing on mental health needs. So we really say to volunteers, what do you like to do? And then we have more than enough work to go around.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to thank Lynn and Dan for coming. I'm going to bring 2 more people up. Thank you very much for your presentation. And we're going to move to Marshall in just a second. But while they're leaving, I want to replace them with Stephanie Tamasweet and Cherry Hoffman, just in the interest of time, to come up. And Marshall, I first heard about Bridgetown Ministries, and colleagues, I hope you'll ask me for a copy of this video, in a video called Jesus, Save Us From Your Followers. And
I just hope you'll ask me for that video. I'd love to share it with you. But Marshall, we're glad you're here. Please identify yourself and tell us a little bit about Bridgetown.
Well, my name is Marshall Snyder. I'm the founder and executive director of Bridgetown, Inc. It's called Bridgetown Ministries, but Bridgetown, Inc. And first time I've ever done this speak here, so I'm excited to be with you and to share what we're doing. And had an interesting thing happen. I'm from Portland. I work in the inner city of Portland, and I work with a lot of different types of people. And one of the people I work with is the homeless. And they do a thing called spanging on the side of the roads where they stand out. They call it spanging. It's a form of begging, but they get change off of you. And I actually had to do that this morning because in Portland we use credit cards for the parking meters. And I didn't have any change, so this nice, lovely lady gave me a dime, and I was able to put 7 minutes in my meter. So I'm going to have to skedaddle out of here as soon as I get
done. We'll pay your ticket.
Yeah, no, it was amazing. So it was really nice. I was all lost trying to figure it out. But anyway, Bridgetown started with just a vision. The mission statement of Bridgetown is loving people because people matter, simply. That's just what it is. And we have our vision statement is to develop and sustain relational environments that create movement within groups and individuals to demonstrate love and generosity lived out in the world. We're a public nonprofit. We decided not to be a religious nonprofit. We decided we'd be religious people that would run a public nonprofit and see what that would be like. And it's been really good for us. And we have a vision path in order to outlive our vision, and one of those, we have a group of mobilizing young people from all over the U.S. into the inner city of Portland, as well as children's focus. We have trucks and the sides full down into stages. We do summer lunch programs in the inner city apartment complexes of North Portland. And then the thing that I'm probably here more for is a thing that we do, an environment called Night Strike. And Night Strike is every Thursday night for 7 years we've gone under the Burnside Bridge, and it started with washing feet, and we just washed the feet of homeless people. We gave them socks and sat and talked with them and had conversation with them. We didn't make proselytization a focus. We made loving people a focus. And if the question came up, we obviously would answer the question. Let's put it that way. And it began to grow because there was no vision. We were just going to wash feet. And last year, my wife just sent me this. Last year in 2010, we were able to serve 14,000 guests, and we at Night Strike alone, along with close to 7,000 volunteers that came through, just under a bridge. A lot of them are young people that come and serve with us. We have about 175 to 100 or so volunteers that come, and then about 350 to 400 homeless that we serve on a weekly basis under the bridge. We feed them, we clothe them, we give conversation to them. We just fold tables. We don't own any buildings. We own all vehicles and trailers, and we move everything under the bridge. We're completely mobile. One of the great things that's happened, because my understanding of this meeting was how we're working with other agencies and other groups, was our relationship with the city of Portland. This has allowed me the opportunity to be a board member on the Old Town Chinatown Neighborhood Association, where I sit on that board and I get to listen to the needs of our city and then focus on meeting the needs of our city, whether it be sweeping the streets or just whatever it would be. And it's been an amazing opportunity, as well as developing one of the first good neighbor agreements with the city of Portland and how we would work together, because some of our clientele can be a little bit more colorful, if you can imagine. And how we would work together in just providing that relationship with them. We did it for the first time this last year, and we came back, met with the Portland police, met with the different groups that we work with. Hands down, they gave us another agreement. We have to pay a parking, we have to pay a fee to be there. We're underneath the Burnside Bridge where the Saturday market is. We have to pay a fee for that. We have to bring in porta potties every week. Our budget for that is $600 a night. We feed 350 people on $600 a night and give socks and love on people in just a tremendous way. The movie that you're talking about is a movie called Lord Save Us From Your Followers.
Sorry.
It's all right. It's on Netflix. You can stream it. So it's a great movie, and the whole idea is just that the church has some work to do, and part of that is the broken relationships that we've made the other groups around us want to put their hands up and stay away from us rather than serving our city and reaching out to the poor. When you read the scripture, there's over 2,000 instances for Christians to serve the poor, and that's a pretty amazing statistic, and we want to keep that at our forefront. So thank you for the opportunity to be here, and if there's any questions, I'd love to answer them.
I'm going to do questions with Marshall now because of his, parking situation.
Marshall, I want to thank you for being here today, and
just letting people know what the church is doing, because one of the things, I'm actually meeting with a group of ministers and stuff, and as a Christian, sometimes I feel kind of bad because I think the situation we've got ourselves into is because we've fallen down and not been doing the work that you're doing. And if we could unite with each other and all churches start working together in the same pattern, we would not be here and dealing with social services at the state level, because God would be doing the work himself. So I thank you for everything that you are doing.
Thank you.
Any more for Marshall?
Please. How do you raise your funds?
Well, I beg. I spange. No. Primarily,
I hope you get more than a dime at a time.
Yeah. The movie Lord Save Us opened up some doors for us, where people came, and all of our grants have come by people knocking on our door. My wife and I run the whole organization out of the living room of our house right now, and that's pretty intense right now as we're growing in leaps and bounds, and so we're expanding that. We're just learning on how to go after grants, but primarily it's just been the good and kindness of people wanting to help, and it's we wrote a budget for about $280,000 this last year, and we're excited about that and see where that's going to go, and working with Murdoch right now in an expansion to expand our structure to make it stronger so that we can receive more grants, because we feel like there's some areas. We're developing a mentoring program. There's a lot of people that are on the streets from here to get into a rescue mission program or relief program. There's a big path that they have to walk to get there. And so we're developing a mentoring program called Beyond the Bridge Mentoring, which will link up people with those people, our guests, to walk with them to help them get to them to a front door of a recovery center. That's a big journey for a lot of people. So we're trying to fill that gap, and hopefully that'll help with some funding as well. So thank you for your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Thank you for coming down today. Appreciate it very,
thank
very
you.
Much.
Bless you. I'm going to go, so I don't...
Yeah, go get it. Thanks again. So, Stephanie, can you help us with the next phase of our hearing?
Can I change chairs here?
You do whatever you want, and just identify yourself for the record, and we're glad you're here.
Sure. So, my name is Stephanie Thomas-Sweet, and I'm here as the co-chair of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. And I secretly always wanted to be a preacher, so I'm going to say amen after
yeah.
Nicely done.
Like I said, I'm here as the co-chair of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. We're a network of about 120 social service providers, agencies, nonprofits, and individuals in the state. And our mission is to promote the dignity of all Oregonians through improved public policy.
Excuse me. Hi. Could you also just move the mic away a tad?
Yes. Sorry.
That's okay. I do the same.
Sorry to interrupt. Been there.
So our mission is to promote the dignity of all Oregonians through improved public policy and support for human services. And just as a note, we do meet as a coalition every Monday, and we welcome you to join us. We meet in 167A here in the Capitol, where we talk about what's happening with the budgets and what's happening to our services that we really care about. So we invite you to come at noon on Monday. Some of our members include Oregon Food Bank, Albertina Kerr Center, Central City Concern, Cascade AIDS Project, and many, many others. And as you've heard today, these are very powerful institutions in our communities, and they help keep our neighborhood safe and strong and healthy, and tremendously proud to stand with them today. And I just want to talk a little bit of what we've been experiencing in the last few years as coalition and individuals in our organizations. As you're well aware, the recession has hit our most vulnerable citizens the hardest, and many Oregonians have lost their homes, their jobs, and thousands go hungry every night, and you're going to hear from some of them. And volunteers from nonprofit communities, in the faith communities, have stepped up really in tremendous ways. I think it's incredible to hear the excitement about what's happening from the folks earlier today, and I know in my own life, I've stepped up as well with my own family and in our church community. Actually, every fourth Sunday, we have what we call an empty service, where we go out into the community and we partner with a local nonprofit and we clean up the neighborhood. This last week, we actually just picked up trash on the streets, and I think it's tremendous to see what people are doing. In the same regard, these same nonprofit organizations have faced similar budget cuts that all of you have been experiencing in the last few years. My own employer has laid off several staff in the last 3 years. We've all taken pay cuts and furlough days, and thousands of churchgoers have lost their own jobs. Tithes have been down. That means that churches have had to cut back on their own staff and their programs, and some have lost even their own facilities due to foreclosure. You may have heard about that. It's happening across the country. I think the economic constraints faced by nonprofits and by faith-based organizations show the interconnectedness of our communities and our budgets and our governments, and shows the real clear partnership that we've heard about today, and that is clear for what we need to have healthy communities and keep them safe and strong. I wanted to thank you for the tremendous investment that this body has made in nonprofit communities across the state. It's really only through the solid partnership that we've been able to maintain services to our most vulnerable. Thousands of jobs are actually supported through the work that you do as our elected leaders and the investments you make in human services. Thousands of jobs are made. We know we leverage federal funds. We match federal funds, which are immediately invested into local communities. They're paid at grocery stores. They're used in the local stores, and they help keep our communities strong, and they help keep the community running. It's clear, and I've already talked about this, but there's really no church that can meet the need. There's no nonprofit alone that can meet the need, and similarly, the state can't meet the need without the vibrant communities of our nonprofit community. So I really think it's only through the solid partnership of us working together that we can be successful. And I concluded in my last statement here, and like I said, an amen at the beginning, but I would just really strongly encourage each of you to find a nonprofit to volunteer with in your own community if you're not already doing so, and to tithe to your local faith community, and to really make a personal investment in your own life as well as in your public life. Thank you very much. I'm happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you. I have a quick one. Do you guys have an HQ? Is the coalition
headquarters? This acronym.
Yeah, sorry.
Our headquarters.
You'd think I'd know, but
no, we're just a volunteer organization. So all of our members come together at a volunteer basis.
Okay, good. Thank you for being here. The one thing I kind of underlined in your testimony, the written testimony, was promote the dignity of all Oregonians, and I really appreciate that. I felt like that came through with Marshall's testimony,
mm-hmm.
and interestingly, I think it's a lot to do with what Cherry's going to share. So thank you for being here, and I'm going to move on.
Big question?
Yeah, please, Representative.
I think you mentioned what proportion of your organization's funds are state-funded. Do you have some sense
of
that?
It's different because we have so many organizations, so I wouldn't be able to speak wholly. I mean, similar to what the answer was, I think, earlier today, some do have zero and probably up to 80-90%. I would say the majority of our organizations have a significant portion of their funds, and you know, significant 25% at least that
Thank
come
you.
From state funds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. While I pass the baton here to Cherry, I'm going to ask Jane Downing to come on up, and she'll be after Cherry. And Cherry, if you'll identify yourself for the record, thank you very much for coming over.
My name is Cherry Hoffman, and I am representing the Wednesday night dinners at they're being held at the First Christian Church in Silverton. About 2008, November of 2008, two of us were into a situation within the church where we had a crisis situation of getting a couple of food boxes out to a couple of families who had just lost their jobs and were in a real problem. So we got to talking about it, the two of us, and we went to our pastor and then to the board of directors. What we asked for was Wednesday night dinner, a spaghetti dinner for a few people who were in a problem. Let's try it for a couple of months and see how it goes. The first Wednesday, we did do a Wednesday night dinner on November 11th, 2008, and it was a spaghetti dinner, and we served 37 people. And 15 of those were couch surfers, people, young kids who were sleeping from couch to couch because they couldn't go home or didn't have a home. So we started that. The next week, we served 60. The next week, we served 75. We've had the once-a-week spaghetti dinner three times now. We had cooks that came in. They started cooking. It was a beautiful thing to see. We had no rules except for three. One is we're not here to save your soul. The second is we're not going to invite you to our church. And the third is we are not a soup kitchen. We opened this up to the community. We put a sign out in front. We have people from all walks of life in there. We have doctors, attorneys. We have our state representative. We have our mayor, city council. We have homeless. We have any type of person you could ask for. And probably a half of the room is filled with very lonely widows that come in once a week and have dinner with us. We just opened it up to the community. As of right now, Tonight, I don't know, so we're going to go higher as of tonight. But as of right now, we have served a total of over 33,000 dinners. We are serving between 350 and 450 people every Wednesday night now. Our minister at 75 was saying, where is our stop? And now we've gone way above that. We have the first Wednesday of every month, St. Paul's Church comes in and they do all of the serving and all of the cleaning up. The third Wednesday of every month, the Friends Church comes in and does the same. And then the other Wednesdays, our church does. However, we are not considered, we do not consider ourselves a church function. Somebody said a while back that we are a community congregation, and I think that says it all. We're very proud of what we do, as you can tell. We are very excited. We don't know when we're going to stop. We don't know if we're going to stop. Every time I'm on the floor, I'm not allowed in the kitchen, so I'm out on the floor. I am a messy cook, and they kicked me out on the third week and said, please don't come back. So our pastor by that time needed me out on the floor. So he and I are out on the floor. We go around. We try to talk to everybody, but when you've got 450 people in the room, it's getting a little bit difficult to do that. However, then in this last September, and this is how we're seeing the lines being blurred between the nominations and between the committee. This last September, we got a phone call. Pastor Steve came to me and asked me if I would take the project on, and I said, absolutely. I am now a supervisor to two young men who are from the Mount Angel Abbey and studying for the priesthood. They're doing their field work down with us at the Wednesday night dinners. They're not allowed to wear their collar. We don't want it advertised, but they do come up, and when they're asked, they say where they're from and what they're doing. It's been a lot of fun to find how comfortable people are in there with each other. We can have somebody who is coming in who obviously is down and out and probably has had some very definite drug problems, and they're sitting at the same table with Representative Gilliam or...
Also down and out, by the way.
Causes indigestion for them.
So, as you can tell, we're a little bit proud of our program, and I'll be really happy to take any questions. Oh, by the way, we're totally self-supporting now. We are not relying on any money except what comes in the donations.
Well said, perfectly.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Yeah, I have one.
Okay.
It's Wednesday.
Yes, I know. I gotta go.
What's for dinner?
By the way, everybody else besides Representative Gilliam, that's really hard for me to say.
Yeah, I know.
Are all invited. We start at 5 o'clock on Wednesday nights, and tonight we're having baked chicken and mashed potatoes and gravy.
Oh, I would be delighted if any of you are, well, this is delicately said, stuck in Salem on Wednesdays, to come over and enjoy the dinner.
Absolutely.
I'll bring you back.
Floor. And we run a little bit on the floor, but we're there, and we would be so thrilled to see any of you come. Thank you.
Representative Winder,
I just wanted to thank you for the work that you do. So I think as we keep going, I want to thank you, Representative Gilliam, for the panel and stuff today, because I know in McMinnville, I think you can go all 6 days and have a meal between one of our churches there, and Newburgh is getting close as well, and I'm proud to see this happening.
Thank you.
All of our cities.
We've had three churches in the Salem area now open up with the same program in their areas, and the Oak Street Church in our church are in our town, and I need to say that. They do the same thing we do, but they do it on Monday nights on a smaller scale. So it's getting out there.
Thank you, Chair.
You're welcome.
While I'm passing the baton to Jane, I'd ask Becca Cardwell and David Leslie to come forward if they're in the room. And welcome, Jane. Identify and
thank
tell us
you.
The story.
Co-Chair Gilliam and Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Jane Downing, and I'm the Executive Director of Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service. And my background is that I have actually worked in the private sector for government and now have been the Executive Director of a nonprofit for over 13 years. Our program provides services to victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, and human trafficking in Marion County. We serve all the county. We're the only program of our kind in Marion County, but Each one of you is represented by a nonprofit who serves victims of domestic and sexual violence in your own communities. Every year, we have we've averaged about 11,000 calls to our crisis line, and this year, though, we received over 14,000 calls. We believe the reason for that is because over 65 women and children have been murdered in the last 2 years in Oregon, and we received many calls where women would say, "I'm afraid I'm the next one. I'm afraid my children are the next one." We house anywhere from 300 to 500 women and children in shelter every year. One half to two-thirds of our shelter residents are usually children, and we're providing every need that they have while they're there with us. We also have support groups in English, Spanish, and Russian. We have transitional housing. We have community education. We trained over 14,000 people in the last 2 years throughout the state of Oregon, and we also have a website that gets about 20,000 contacts a month. The reason why I want you to know all of those pieces is because we have 10 staff. 10 staff and 50 volunteers who do all of this work every single day, and they work really hard. We're one of those nonprofits that do receive some state funding. 27% of our funding is state funding. 17% is community donations, and we're really proud of the fact that our community does support us, but we're also one of those nonprofits that heard from a lot of people in the last couple of years saying, "We can no longer donate to you." We're lucky that they're coming into our office and spending time with us, but that doesn't pay the heat bill in shelter. That makes it really difficult for us. We have been incredibly lucky to have a wonderful partnership with the faith community, with community partners, with the Department of Justice and the Department of Human Services, which together we have built a strong network to be able to provide for victims of domestic and sexual violence. And while I understand wanting to look at how much more nonprofits can do, I'm telling you, we're at the point of not being able to do more with what we have, because we're stretched really thin. My staff works long hours, more hours than they really should, but they're dedicated to what they do. They care about their community. They care about the folks that they're working with, and they're willing to do it. But we've actually had to cut back on staff at a time when the calls are increasing, the need is increasing. We see it in so many places. And so it makes us a little nervous to lose those community partners, that they provide really quality services for what they do and then help us to be able to do more of what we do. They do some of the behind-the-scenes kind of oversight pieces, especially helping small nonprofits in rural areas. And then we're able to focus in on working with families and helping them every single day to move towards from crisis to self-sufficiency. I love when we get to see families rebuild their lives free of violence, and we get to see that every single day. I invite any of you to come over and see what we do. We love to give tours, and I always tell folks, we'll give you the nickel tour. I promise it's worth a whole nickel. Come down, see what we do, see the lives that we're changing, and how those partnerships with what the state has done with us, what community partners have done with us, how we actually can ultimately end violence in our communities. We work every day to put ourselves out of a job. Have you ever thought about that? We work every day to put ourselves out of a job. We want you all to help us be doing that work with them. And I'm happy to take any questions that you might have about our work and what we do. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you.
Thank you. We got a question over here, but I wanted to ask you, forgive me, but would you repeat the figure of how many Oregonians are murdered?
More than 65 women and children have been murdered in the last 2 years. We've had two just in the last month in Oregon that have been murdered, one in Kaiser.
So. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. And you know, again, kind of more commentary than anything. I again, really appreciate you being here. And we heard, you know, on House Bill 2856 this morning, this notion of streamlining reporting and auditing. And I'm struck by one of the testimony around Morris and Child and Family Services of Portland responded to 44 requests for audits, and it cost their staff $321,780. And when I look at the layers that we've created at the agency level, $321,000 that didn't go to help families is a little bit appalling to me. And just know that, you know, I think the folks who are on this panel are very committed to trying to find ways to get DHS to sharpen their pencil so that more of those dollars hit the front line, because, you know, the work that you guys are doing is hugely important, and the flexibility and the nimbleness and the way that you can stretch a penny. My food bank in my community, who is not part of the Oregon Food Bank, you know, they go to the Albertsons with coupons to save money so they can get toothbrushes and things that aren't normally donated. I mean, these are folks, the people in this room and who come up to this panel are hugely resourceful with these dollars, and they are doing it because it's coming from a passion in their heart, and I hear it in your voice as you've shared your story. So I am hugely appreciative. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of the folks in the building, and maybe a few of you know, I wouldn't be sitting here if the folks who are sitting in the audience didn't do this work for my family. So I am going to be adamant that we find ways at the agency level to sharpen our pencils to get you more money this session so that it actually winds up where it needs to be. So thank you for sharing that.
Thank you. And co-chairs and Representative Parrish, I would like to say, actually, Department of Justice and DHS in our case actually have streamlined all the processes. They've actually worked together to do a joint RFP where we're doing our grant requests and also all of our reporting. And so they've actually done some of the things I heard you talking about this morning already for our programs. So all across the state, our programs do have a very streamlined service that we're doing with that. And so I'm very appreciative that you're looking at that. And you may look to them to actually be a model in this regard, because it's been a wonderful process. And I'm one of those folks, I write about 20 to 30 grants a year, so I'm so appreciative when folks are talking about that and looking at it.
Can I just,
please,
you know, I could sit here and have my thoughts on where waste is in the system, but you all deal with this every day and you know where the inefficiencies are, and I would suggest that you reach out to any of us on this panel and tell us where to go look for those inefficiencies so that we can solve them, we can untangle what needs to be untangled in statute or in rule or wherever the problem lies, so that more of these dollars come out the pipeline where they need to be. So,
thank you.
And I would add, let us offline sometime talk to the co-chair and I. Maybe we can discuss that nickel tour at some point.
Yeah. Thank you. Wonderful. We would love
so
that.
Much for being here. I'm going to move on, and I'm going to ask Becca Cardwell to tell us about Port City.
Hi, am I far enough away?
You're perfect.
You can hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. My name is Becca Cardwell. I'm the Executive Director of Port City Development Center, and we are in North Portland. Rep. Frederick, thank you. He actually lives in our neighborhood, and he came to one of our fundraisers and spoke. And thank you for having us here today. It's nice to come here. First of all, I'm just going to give you a little bit of statistics. We are funded through the state approximately 63 to 65% of our annual budget, and we are at about $2.4 million. One of the things that I'm very proud of that our staff has been able to do is they have they've recruited volunteers. They've gotten in-kind donations that equal about 5% of our budget, which is huge. I feel that it's huge. We have probably over 100 volunteers that come in every month, and we've got lots of equipment that was donated to us, specifically looms. We have a fiber arts program that does weaving, and we have about 6 or 7 gigantic looms that people donated, and these things are very expensive new. So we also have a program that does a lot of sewing, that they make quilts and tea towels and coffee cozies. And actually, Senator Shields was one of the first individuals to purchase one of these coffee cozies, which was fun to have him there. So everything that goes towards making these individualized type products, everything is donated. all of the equipment, all of the fabrics, everything. And that to me is really speaks highly of the community as it has gotten involved with Port City. It'd probably be helpful if you knew what we did. We provide services to adults with developmental disabilities, and it's very similar to Dan from Tualatin Valley Works in what we do. The individuals we serve have a whole range of disabilities. Some people need daily living care, such as toileting. You know, these are the different things that we are providing to people up to being a support system for them. A lot of what our staff end up doing, actually, I think inadvertently, is they're advocates for individuals in their personal lives, and that is a big. That's something also that I'm very proud of, is that the staff, like you were saying with yours, they're very committed to their jobs, and they don't do it for the money, because we don't get much of that. As an organization, we're very lean, and we're going to suffer more cuts, and it's hard for me to cut into the muscle of our organization, but that's what I'm going to have to do. The same, what you were mentioning with the ATE program, the Alternative to Employment program, if that's cut, we may not be able to serve close to 60 of the individuals that we currently serve. And the total that we serve right now are 132. So the Alternative to Employment program is incredibly important. It would be a great disservice to the individuals all across the state to have that taken from them, because often they have no outlet, and the Alternative to Employment programs help individuals to be included in their communities and have activities to do. Also, again, we're very fortunate where we're located. We're actually zoned residential. However, we have three large warehouses, so it's kind of bizarre. But at any rate, where we're located is within a community. So we're very fortunate that the surrounding community has taken such a great interest in our organization, and the staff have done a great job of going out and recruiting volunteers and getting the immediate community and the larger community involved in what we're doing. This particular industry is hard. It's hard to fundraise for because we are so heavily supported by state and federal dollars. But we're doing the best we can, and we do it as creatively as we can. Just so you know, we have a bluegrass festival. Okay, she's the development director. On May 7th, and you are definitely all invited with different bluegrass type bands from the Portland area, and lots of beer. So, and again, thanks for having us here. But please, whatever you can do with the ATE, please save it, because it's incredibly important to the individuals that we serve.
Thank you, Becca. And I was particularly pleased to hear about the charitable side of Senator Shields. All of us were very happy to see him go. And I just say that because we got Representative Frederick. Oh, certainly wouldn't want to cause any problem with Representative Shields. Do you have a comment?
If I may, please.
Yeah.
Chair Gilliam. I want to thank you again. The tours I've gotten and the conversations we've had over there have been really great. One of the things that folks may not know is that if you find yourself in a Portland restaurant, you may be eating produce coming from Port City, especially during the spring and summer. They have taken over what had been in a series of abandoned lots and have made them into a garden that is just extraordinary. And it is literally right down the street from me. So it's amazing what you've been able to do, and the support that you have in the community is because you have supported the community. So thank you again.
Yeah, and we continue to annex land in North Portland in order to create farms. The Emanuel Hospital has allowed us to use a portion of their farm. I mean, their land.
Want to know more about that. That's good to hear.
Yeah.
Representative Wagner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For your fundraiser, I just want to make sure you're not serving homebrew, because I don't think we'll have that issue taken care of quite yet.
Can you explain what you mean?
No. No. You'll hear about it. It's been on the news.
I'll be there either way.
Okay.
God bless the fun, the development folks. And I would lead, I like bluegrass, but I would lead with the beer part.
Well, it's Rogue Brewery, Deschutes, Widmer, and who else? Those three breweries.
Where is the Bluegrass Festival in May?
It's going to be in North Portland. It's on 2124 North Williams Avenue.
Okay.
And there will be several bands playing at one time and, you know, just all sorts of fun.
Good. Thank you, Becca.
Corner of Williams and Tillamook.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Let's go to his calendar.
From Ecumenical Ministries, David, we're happy you're here.
Good morning. Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Tomei, and members of the committee, especially my Representative Parrish. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify this morning. I am David Leslie, Executive Director of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. We are a statewide organization of Christian denominations, congregations, interfaith partners, and others working to improve the lives of all people in the state and really promoting the dignity of all communities, especially those living on the margins. You asked a little bit, our budget is about $3.5 million a year. We have 50 staff, 500 core volunteers. About 50% of our funds are raised privately every year. Another 50 come from a variety of public entities, both at the federal, state, county, and local levels. So a lot of the private funds then are used to help leverage public funds in our services. The recession that Oregon is facing is having a clear impact on our members and other faith communities throughout the state. As you've heard today, fiscal crises have led many congregations and faith-based cooperative ministries in the local communities to lay off staff, reduce hours, cut back on the number of services offered. I think what's really striking and where we've seen a real sea shift in the last few years is that the needs that at one time used to be considered the purview of the poor, outside of the purview of the local congregation, say layoffs, home foreclosures, the lack of health insurance, are realities that are now impacting members of congregations themselves. Not that they never have not, I mean they have, but with greater and greater numbers. And while these internal needs are increasing, so too are the external needs. Like many nonprofits serving Oregon communities, we at EMO are facing dramatic increase in the demands for services. We have a very, very large emergency food program in Cully neighborhood in northeast Portland. In the last year alone, we've seen the numbers increase 40%. Many of the people we're seeing are people that have never, ever been in any kind of social service program or ministry for needs. And I think what's of concern, the question was asked earlier about chronic conditions of people. What I really worry about is a new movement of chronic need that it's starting. We're starting to see another cycle. We see this, though, across the board in community ministries throughout the state that are part of our network. So it's a real concern that we have right now in trying to work with our members and congregations how to meet these new and very complex needs. But in spite of all these challenges, I see every day that Oregon's religious communities are finding new ways to both serve their members and the larger community. A couple examples this morning. First United Methodist Church in Corvallis, for example, a community we worked with thanks to grants from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, from healthcare systems foundations, and from national dollars from the United Methodist Church and the Presbyterian Church USA. We've been working with them to create food security programs that can be designed and run out of local congregations in partnership with the larger community. At First United Methodist Church, they, through a renovation process, developed a commercial-grade kitchen, and now has opened its kitchen to low-income residents who are interested in starting small, like micro-industry development food businesses so that they're able to improve their economic livelihood while at the same time providing a service to the community. I know you have the Director of Human Solutions in the room today, and I just wanted to mention that another great example is Eastminster Presbyterian Church in Portland. a very small congregation with 38 members. Average age is about 79, which is pretty typical of a lot of congregations in Oregon. Their pastor called maybe a couple of years ago thinking if we're going to shut the congregation down. But this last year developed a partnership with Human Solutions to provide a warming center for homeless people in the community, which
David,
has given new life to the...
Sorry. Yes. What community is East Ministry in Portland?
It's in East Portland. And Jean, I think Jean DeMaster is here. She can actually give you the street address. But she's in the back, but it's on the east side of the state. But I think the thing that is, again, striking, and I think some people don't realize, I would say an average congregation in the state of Oregon has under 100 members and probably is under 75 members. So when we're thinking about capacity, just keep that in mind. But it's amazing to see this little congregation find a way to have new life and serve the community at the same time. There are many other ways that congregations, of course, in Oregon, you've heard a lot of that, are serving the communities that they live in. What we're really trying to work with our faith communities is to say that this is a time that really the doors have to be open. There's a real concern, too, about the loss of congregations. There are many that are on the margin. You heard some of that this morning also. Our concern is that when a congregation closes, you lose the public entity in that community, a place for art galleries, for after-school programs, nutrition, food pantry outlets. I do believe with Oregon Food Bank Network, faith-based institutions are the largest group of providers or places where emergency food is delivered. It's a very concern, and we're trying to work on new models for ministry. I would say that a critical feature of many of the programs, community ministries, church-based, faith-based programs, are carried out through partnerships between religious communities, nonprofit organizations, and a variety of public governmental agencies to ensure that services are delivered in a cost-effective and truly collaborative manner. At EMO, for example, over the last couple of years, we're working with the state of Oregon on the Healthy Kids Initiative. We're one of the, what I would call, intermediary organizations. What we're doing through that program is helping to develop the capacity of churches and faith-based ministries to identify overlooked families and children that may need health services, and oftentimes done in culturally specific ways that are not going to be done with just a cookie-cutter type approach. We firmly believe that effectively meeting today's and tomorrow's challenges requires that this type of partnership, and the bottom line is no one sector can solve the problems of the day. I mean, I think that's a simple reality. So in this spirit, in conclusion, my hope is that in the days ahead we'll redouble our efforts and that this committee and others can help lead the way and help reinforce this idea of collaborative partnership and help provide new opportunities for collaborative efforts, bringing together all sectors of Oregon society in service to one another and our neighbors in need. Working together, we firmly believe, and we experience every day, we are much more likely than working apart to ensure that all Oregonians, no matter their life circumstances, live lives full of possibility and hope. Again, thank you for the opportunity to testify and to be a part of the collaborative network in this state that it really does bring together all these sectors day in and day out.
Thank you, David. Representative.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I apologize that I have to leave for a previous meeting, but I've always admired Ecumenical Ministries' work, and it reminds me today. I had a conversation yesterday with the religious editor of the Oregonian, who's talking about writing an article on how our faith affects our activities in the legislature. And thinking about this, I was raised in the Jewish tradition of Tikkun Olam, which translates to repairing the earth as being a part of the basic social welfare responsibility out of the Jewish community, and they've been very much involved in some of these, and it's very interesting to see how important that tradition is, however it's translated into the religious community. And I think Ecumenical Ministries is probably, you know, is a beacon of what the religious community can do in terms of sharing all of our responsibilities to repair the earth. I thank you for organizing this.
Thank you for sharing that, Representative Greenland. Representative Parrish.
Well, a couple things. First, I'd like to, you know, thank David for his work. I will just say, of all of the lobby types in the building who come to us with a goal or mission and want our ear, he can kind of get mine anytime he wants because he lives right next door. So it's convenient. When I have questions, I know where to go knock. And in that piece, they do so much around the food conversation, and David and his wife are just so lovely to be neighbors with, and we, you know, his wife and I have had a lot of conversations around food and how do you use it to help folks. And so for the folks who do food in the room, I'm actually going to do my own little pitching here.
Good.
House Bill 3545 next week gets a hearing. I would encourage you to look that up and come help me out and try to look at alternative ways to put food into the system. Essentially, this is leveraging home ownership to put food into the system. And David, since he lives next door, can certainly share what we've done in our neighborhood and what we're trying to do, some of us around food and putting that into the system. And so I just appreciate the work that David does. And he used to work longer hours than me, and now I think I have him beat.
I would just say on the food, the First United Methodist Church example comes out of an initiative we started a few years ago called the Interfaith Food and Farm Partnership, with the idea of connecting, much like a community-supported ag model, of connecting congregations to actually farmers in the state. And it's everything from running farmers markets in congregations, really, right after worship on Sunday, or in case of a Jewish synagogue, Friday night, where you're building in a base of consumers, connecting them to that local farmer. The Robert Wood Johnson grant was to deal with childhood obesity and really trying to work with congregations, say, what kind of assets do you have? Do you have a gymnasium? Do you have acreage that's not being used for community gardens or walking trails? But the idea, you see the message in here, is to say faith values, very easy to connect to very practical things that you can do, but realizing the only way it's going to be done is in partnership with others. So we partner with Ag Extension, with nutritionists, with Department of Human Services, with others, because it really does take that village-type approach.
Thank you for saying so. Thank you to this panel. I've got one more panel that's signed up, and I want to mentioned that I know there's others in the room. I've gotten their notes, and I will attempt, and I think I will get you up here. I appreciate your patience, and I certainly appreciate my colleagues hanging in there with me. I think we're going to make it, so I'd like to call up. Who's here from Developmental Disabilities Committee? If not, I'm just going to keep moving. Then I'd like to have Philip Kennedy Wong come up and Patty Whitney Wise. And I think we've got somebody from the Cascade AIDS Project. Is that correct? Is there somebody in the room? If not, I want to move to there's a person from Representative Wan's district on Children's and Family Services. Who's that? Good. If you'll come up.
Yeah.
You'll be the next panel. And this is an incredible thing. Usually when I chair and we go this long, Representative Tomei is asleep by now. And John Mullen has thrown something. So this is really historic, and I really appreciate everybody hanging in there. And please identify yourself, and in your case, Philip, just to where you went to high school.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, Philip Kennedy Wong, class of 1988, Franklin High School, Southeast Portland.
Philip was a freshman when I was a senior, I think.
He used to beat me up on a regular basis. So, thank you very much for having me. I'm here representing the Oregon Food Bank, and I'm going to take a slightly different tack than some of the testimony that you heard, and just focus more on how the Oregon Food Bank organizes itself as a system to achieve the economy of scale that we believe is necessary to distribute food to hungry Oregonians throughout the state. And I'll try to be as brief as I can, and I've asked to have materials distributed to you so you could actually review it on your own later, and I'll speak more about what they are. And certainly if you have any questions about any of the information in them, feel free to contact me. So let me just start by stating what the mission of the Oregon Food Bank is. It's pretty obvious. It's to eliminate hunger and its root causes, because no one should be hungry. And the Oregon Food Bank essentially For those who aren't as familiar with how we're structured, not only are we a nonprofit, but we actually serve as the hub of a statewide network that encompasses 947 partner agencies throughout Oregon and Clark County, Washington. We recover food from farms, manufacturers, wholesalers, retailers, individuals, and government sources. And then we distribute that food to the 20 regional food banks across the state of Oregon. And four of those regional food banks are actually run by the Oregon Food Bank itself. And we have facilities in Tillamook, Ontario, and in two in the Portland metropolitan area. Let me take you to one of the handouts that you received. It's the Oregon Food Bank Network Regional Profile, and I want to turn your attention to page 4. It's not really numbered, so you'll have to count the number of pages to get to it, but there's a great chart here, looks like this, and it kind of gives you a sense of how the Oregon Food Bank Network system is organized. And I emphasize this because one of the things that we've recognized is that we have to have partnerships with other nonprofits, obviously partnerships with the private sector, and then obviously because we have a presence in the state capital, partnerships with the state. And I'm glad and very happy to report that the state has been a good partner with the Oregon Food Bank system. And if you look at this chart, you can see the Oregon Food Bank in the center, but you can see where we get the types of foods that we get and how we in turn distribute that food across the state. And so I want to have you also flip over that page to this chart here, because I want to give you a sense of the breadth of the food bank network system. Again, you know, emphasizing the point of economy of scale, where the Oregon Food Bank distributes food to another regional facility, and that facility then distributes food across to the food pantries. So if you see this chart here, it looks like this. You can actually see the types of programs in each of the 20 regional food bank areas that are part of the network. In fact, three of those partner agencies actually testified this morning before this committee: the Silverton Area Community Aid Food Bank, the Union Gospel Mission, and the First Christian Church of Silverton. And you can see that of the different types of organizations that are part of the network. So with that said, now you have some sense of how we're structured. Let me tell you what we've seen in terms of the impact of the economy has had on Oregonians. So I'm going to quickly turn your attention to the other handout, and that is the one that looks like this. It has the color green in it. Looks like this. And if you go to the upper right-hand corner, it gives you a sense of the amount of food that the food bank network system has had to distribute in terms of the demands that we are seeing from all of our partner agencies. A total of 72 million pounds of food was distributed through this system, which is pretty high in terms of what we've seen in the past. And just in terms of numbers, we distributed roughly 917,000 emergency food boxes, and these food boxes are typically 3 to 5 day supply of food. It was actually a 17% increase in a number of food boxes. So that's a lot of food. And as you've heard from some of the folks today, we are seeing people that have never been unemployed in their entire life. And we're also seeing people who have been actually volunteers at some of these food pantries actually coming in as clients themselves. So it just kind of gives you a sense of the breadth of the impact of the recession. But most importantly, I think the point that I want to leave you with is that it is a shared partnership. We can't, as my former colleague David Leslie mentioned, we are all interconnected in this fight to end poverty and other of the social ills of our society. So we definitely want to continue the partnership with the state, and we certainly hope to get like your support as state legislators to ensure the state provides a kind of environment where nonprofits can thrive, but also obviously the private sector, so we can get jobs created. So with that, that sort of ends like my brief overview, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Let's hold questions with after Patty's presented, and then we'll get to Representative Parrish. Patty, okay. Thank you very much.
Patty Whitney Wise, the Executive Director for the Oregon Hunger Task Force. And I have another hat on today, especially for Co-Chair Gilliam. I'm a PS. You're a PK. I'm a pastor's spouse.
Very nice.
You're welcome.
So just for those of you who may not know, the Hunger Task Force was created by this legislative body in 1989. It includes legislators and state agencies and nonprofits. It's a wonderful collaboration that over the years has leveraged a lot of program dollars for people in local communities. And I just want to outline a couple of those. One is the SNAP program, which is formerly known as food stamps. Back in the year 2000, when we had quite a severe hunger problem, we were serving about 57% of the eligible food stamp or SNAP clients in the state. We partnered with the Department of Human Services and local counties and nonprofit and also foundations and raised some money to start doing an outreach program around the state. Today, we are reaching upwards of 90% of those eligible and bringing in over $1 billion a year in federal food stamp or SNAP benefits that benefit local communities, help feed families, help generate a lot of an economic activity for communities, especially in rural areas. Another project that we worked on is child nutrition outreach for summer food. This is one Representative Parrish, I'm sure, is very familiar with your background in food services. We've helped to expand school breakfast. We've helped to expand after-school meal and snack. And, in fact, because of the partners at the task force table, we were able to be one of the first pilot states to bring that federal program, the after-school meal and snack program, into the state, which serves hundreds of thousands of children every year now. We've also worked hard to bring in fruit and vegetable vouchers for women, children, and seniors so that they're able to purchase fruits and vegetables from local farmers market and roadside stands. And that's such a wonderful win-win program. Both the local farmers win by having more customers, and the low-income families and seniors win by being able to purchase fresh fruits and vegetables, which are often the most expensive item in their budget, and it's very hard on a limited income to purchase those fresh items. The other thing we've done is create two strategic plans over the last few years to help involve all of Oregon in the work that we do. The Oregon Food Bank, Ecumenical Ministries, and others serve on our task force, and together we have made a big impact. And I have attached for you some of those accomplishments. One I wanted to mention specifically is a partnership with the businesses in the last two summers. We, because of the budget cutbacks in the last biennium, a lot of summer schools had to close down, and we were concerned that there wouldn't be a place for kids to get food during the summer because they were getting those meals through a lot of the summer food sites. We went to some of our business community partners and said, this is a big concern. Would you help us raise some money to provide seed grants for local communities to pick up the slack where the schools were not going to be able to meet the need? And I'm happy to say that last summer we raised $126,000 that went out to all corners of the state to local communities to help them expand their services, and that leveraged over $590,000 in federal food program benefits coming in for those kids. So just to give you that sense that through the task force, there's been a lot of that public-private partnerships going on for a number of years, and it was I really thank the legislature for creating the task force because it does give you a really good model of how all of those communities together can work together. And lastly, I just wanted to mention personally, my husband, in his work as a minister at All Saints Episcopal Church, he retired at the end of September. For years, that church has done a Saturday meal program for customers in the community. It's a collaboration between a number of churches. They receive food through the Oregon Food Bank, which, just so that you're mindful of that, the Oregon Food Bank does receive a modest amount of money from the state, $2 million. It went down a little bit with the allotments, but that leverages so many services in local communities, and that food then is able to come to all of those congregations to help them in the services that they're providing. In this recession, we experienced in our congregation a lot of parishioners losing their jobs, much more so than in any past time that I can remember. Many of them were very strong supporters of the Hot Meals program. Some of them were no longer able to contribute. Some of them had to come to my husband for assistance with rent and utilities themselves, and were just very distressed that they were in that position. And of course, we did not have the money as a congregation to serve all of the needs there. The Hot Meals program is still there, running strong. I think what's hard for many congregations like ours is that trying to expand beyond that is tough right now because of all the needs within the congregation itself. And in fact, part of the reason my husband retired at the end of September is that the church was struggling to be able to afford a full-time pastor. This is not an uncommon experience in Oregon right now. I just want to put that out there because I know how much we want the nonprofit and the religious community to step up to the plate, and they have in so many ways. And yes, there is still room for them to step up more, but they are also experiencing all of those cuts as well. And many of them do get those state dollars, whether they realize it or not. Even the Silverton Food Bank indirectly gets state dollars through the contributions from the Oregon Food Bank.
To Representative Greenlick's earlier point.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So we have to be really careful as we move forward as a state in preserving a safety net for families. So, I mean, for me, for them to fall into homelessness creates so many more problems. So if we can help provide that basic safety net for people between our partnerships with the state and the business community and nonprofits and the religious community, we will succeed in helping to rebuild a strong Oregon. If we fail in that, we're going to have a lot of problems down the line. So I just want to thank you very much for the opportunity to share with you today.
Thank you, Patty, Representative.
Thank you. Well, then I have two things, because you made me wait the first one.
That's right.
Okay. I'm 6 years ago, I think it was 6 years ago, I made the very unpopular choice to start a summer feeding program in a community where they thought that they didn't need it. And yet it's thriving, and I think they serve on average at least 200 plus kids sometimes in the summer in Wilsonville, where, you know, again, folks don't always think that there's need there, and it wasn't a popular decision when I made the choice to do it, and I did it anyway.
We were very thankful that you did.
And that great trained personality. So I'm appreciative of you calling attention to that, because, you know what, whether you agree with the government paying for those things or not, it's not a kid's fault that they don't have a sandwich for lunch. So, question for you, though. Can you speak specifically for us to your relationship with Oregon's farmers and the farm community and the donations that you receive? Because I kind of have the sense that this summer is commodity prices are going up, and farmers are trying to get better with their business practices, and they're streamlining and they're finding efficiencies, that has an implication for the types of donations that you might receive this year.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, and Rep. Parrish, the Oregon Food Bank has, I would describe, a good partnership with, you know, Oregon farmers. There's about 24 gleaning networks. If for those of you who aren't familiar with what gleaning is, it's essentially, small groups that go to farms to take produce that can't be used in a commercial setting, and that's a big part of, well, actually a very important part of the Oregon Food Bank Network's ability to get fresh produce to the hungry in Oregon, because that's, as some of you might know, it's hard to get a hold of as far as fresh produce, especially in terms of like donations. I mean, there are other organizations like the Fresh Alliance that we work with, where it tries to turn around fresh produce that have reached a point where
they'll
it's commercial.
Keep going. I'm going to ask the three representatives from the, you stay right where you are, and they'll just take a, what do we call that, in the batter's box.
The
batter's box.
Go ahead.
So to answer your your question, yes, we have a strong relationship. And just to let members of the committee know, we testified earlier in support of the crop donation tax credit program. And I know the state legislature is looking very closely at all the tax credits. But the reason why we came forward to support it is that we know how important the role that farmers play in fighting hunger. And, you know, we see it as a benefit because it not just, provides fresh produce, but it also serves as building community, connecting farmers to local communities, to people that are actually benefiting from the work that they do. So it's definitely something that that we hope to continue to support. And I want to say roughly, we received 189,000 pounds of donated crops in the past year, just in terms of donated crops.
Colleagues, if you'll hang with me for 10 more minutes, we're not on the floor till 11. I'd really appreciate it, and I'd like to turn it over to my co-chair.
Thank you. Oh, I just have a statement to make. The governor's food drive just ended, and we collected what was the equivalent of 4.2 million pounds of food, and this was no tax. State tax dollars went into this. This was contributions that people in the legislature made and state agencies, and it was the largest food drive in the state. So we have a lot to commend ourselves for. So thank you.
Thank you for telling us that. Who has sent the Wookiee around? That was a big fundraiser for them.
We ended up, in Patrick Sheehan's office.
Oh, did it?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Philip. So please, come on up. Can you split 5 minutes? Okay. We're glad you're here, but we're running out of time, and we just would like to get you on record. Thank you so much. Identify yourself and tell us the story.
Thank you so much for letting us have this time. We know you're pushed for time, and we always collaborate, so splitting 5 minutes is no problem.
Okay.
My name is Jean DeMaster. I'm the director of Human Solutions. Human Solutions serves the communities of Gresham, Fairview, Troutdale, Wood Village, Corbett, and the areas of Multnomah County east of 82nd. Some people don't believe there's any part of Multnomah County east of 82nd, but that's the area that we serve. This community includes about 220,000 people. Includes some of the highest pockets of poverty in Multnomah County. And in some of the communities, over 22% of the children live in poverty. The unemployment rate is 12 to 15%. Income levels are much lower than other areas of Multnomah County and in the state. As a result, what Human Solutions provides is services to homeless and low-income people. Every night, we serve about 190 homeless families. That's about 500 homeless people. So imagine a movie theater, a big movie theater, packed full of people. That's the number of homeless families we serve every single night. Many people think that there are more people who are single who are homeless than our families. But now in Multnomah County, 58% of the homeless are people and families. 34% of the homeless in Multnomah County are children. It's a staggering statistic. What we do is we provide services, shelter, and housing services to those homeless families. We have 14 different programs. None of the 14 programs have enough money to operate on their own. Many of them are government-funded, but none of them have the full amount of funding. So Human Solutions raises about $500,000 every year to keep these programs going. Because we know that families want to become self-sufficient, we also provide employment programs, and because many of the families we serve are about to become homeless, we provide energy assistance. We operate the energy assistance through the State Housing and Community Services Program and serve about 8,500 households with energy assistance. Imagine 8,500 households with their utilities shut off, but that's what would happen if we weren't providing utility assistance. And finally, we provide affordable housing. We believe that families should pay about 30% of their income in their housing. Many of the families we serve pay 60, 70, 80% of their income in housing, and that's why they don't have enough money for food or for prescriptions or for clothing. So the services we provide assist very low-income families. I just want to say real quickly that we believe that collaboration and partnerships are really important, but they're not free. Collaboration and partnership also costs money, and that if you provide money for partnerships, there has to be providing money for the cost of doing that partnership itself. Thank you.
Thank you, Jean.
And my name's Glenna Hayes. I'm the director of the Center for Family Success, and we're a small nonprofit located pretty much in the middle of the territory Gene just mentioned, right on the border between Gresham and Portland in Rockwood. And you've probably heard of our community. We also are in the middle of the intense gang activity there in East Multnomah County, so it's a pretty busy neighborhood. And we serve a very specific subset of the folks that Gene just described, and they, besides having the issues of poverty, they also are children who have a parent who's been involved in the criminal justice system, and their caregivers and their families, and we serve the whole family. I'm not going to talk about what I wrote on this paper. This is some of the services we provide. I will just say we do feed everybody who comes to us for a parenting class or whatever, because we know that that is the pressing issue on their mind until they see that food and they know they can, you know, make it through their parenting class. But what I wanted to call your attention to is a couple, a resource for you, actually. Our neighbors to the north, Washington State, Department of Corrections, and the Department of Human Services there collaborated, and they did a study on children who ever had a parent in the prison system. And what they found was that those children are much more likely to enter the human services system. Once they're in, they use a much wider variety, the whole continuum of services. They use them at a higher level, and they use them for a longer period of time. So what we learned from our neighbors, and I really believe it's got to be very similar in Oregon, is that by focusing on this group of families, these children, we can, one, prevent them from going into that system, which we know we have to do, and we can also provide interventions that help those families get back together and be productive citizens and raise their children. So that's kind of what we do at the center. We're both a prevention and an intervention. And the partnership that we have that I haven't heard mentioned today is we partner with education, higher education, Portland State, Mount Hood Community College, all the social services departments, social work, and we are engaging a lot of semi-professional and professional students in providing services through an internship program. And I think that's probably utilized by a lot of the organizations that have talked to you today, but I think it's a really important opportunity, one, to get really good services into our organizations, but also to educate those folks through their contact with what we do and the focus we have. We also use interns in the prisons to provide the parenting program in the prison as well. So a really important intersection, and I really appreciate the opportunity to bring it to your attention.
Well, thank you for being here and for your written testimony as well.
Good morning. My name is Gloria Wiggins, and I really appreciate your time to listen to us today. I'm the division manager of Catholic Charities at Programa Hispano. So as a division of Catholic Charities, we have been in Gresham since 1982, 29 years serving, and we serve everybody, but we, of course, target the Latino community. And I just want to mention that the changes in the demographics in this county, not only related to poverty, but also to diversity. The communities of color have grown, and I just can mention that in Troutdale and Fairview, the Latino population, just to mention one, is around 12%, and recent data from the census shows that the Latinos in Gresham are around 18%. Many of those live in poverty, so we work with them to offer all the services that regular social services provide. We do information and referral. We have limited rent assistance. We really believe that people are here for a reason, to have a better life, and you can't live forever on limited rent assistance or SNAP or food boxes. So we partner with many agencies like Human Solutions, and we do our piece to help folks to find jobs, to enhance their marketable skills so they can improve their income and have a better quality of life. We work at the schools also, preventing dropouts, gang activity, and making kids to be successful. And we run a very successful tax clinic also. And we, these years, we are open, in the past years, we opened 2 days a week, and this year we have to open 4 days a week because we didn't cope with the number of people willing to pay taxes. Imagine that. And I just have to say that one of our programs that received funding from the state is the domestic violence program. We have one crisis line in Spanish, and we receive around 300 calls a week, and this is a big issue, and you know, we collaborate with all the shelters. We have a really good system of partners in Multnomah County, and that's the source of our referrals especially. But we work with volunteers, of course. Our tax clinic is based on volunteer work. We have several attorneys, CPAs, and people, just regular folks that took the training to be able to help. But I think that it's important to consider that the diversity in our communities. And as we have more and more people, communities of color moving to Oregon, and the Oregonian had last week a very interesting report, we have to be ready to serve those people. And it's just not there are many barriers, and I think it's important for you to consider those barriers. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Could I have two quick questions?
Absolutely. Yeah, well, just before you ask it, I'm going to ask John Ludlow to come up if he's still in the room. He's not. He is. John, I'm going to give you a minute, right, as soon as this question is over. I'm sorry.
Then
I'm going to land our little plane here with the person that helped us take off, and I'm going to ask Carrie Hoops to come up and just give us one word at the end. So please
one
go
word.
Ahead with your question.
That's a lot. Did I hear you say you got 300 calls about domestic violence a week?
Yeah.
In the Hispanic community?
They go from really serious ones to, you know, my friend, I think she's been abused, what
right.
should I do?
Right.
You know, so... it's a way to
just keep some
startling.
Yeah,
yes,
startling.
Okay. You said that was in the Hispanic community.
Yeah. Well, we get people from but the current line is answered in Spanish or for a bilingual person.
Yeah. And the second question is, how do you get your funding? I don't think any of you mentioned that.
For Human Solutions, the funding is about 50% from the state, the county, or the federal government pass-through funds. About 40% of our funds are from rents because we provide affordable housing, and we raise the other 10% from fundraisers, bake sales, car washes, all of those things.
Great, thank you.
And we have funding from the Portland Children's Levy. We also have a federal Second Chance Act grant for family-based substance abuse treatment program that comes through Multnomah County, and we are getting about a third of our support from private foundations.
Thank you.
Thank
I'm going to ask John to come up. Did
real fast. This lady didn't tell me.
65% of our funding comes from the local county, city, state, mostly for domestic violence and federal grants. And then we have private foundations and the base of donors from the church.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And your representative is not on this committee.
Right.
And I'm hoping that you have reached out to him and met with him, because I don't know that there's anybody who is more avidly passionate about where he lives than Representative Wand.
He said you have to come.
So, good. I'm glad that you've connected with him. Thank you.
Crash. We were invited.
That's great. That's great.
Glad you're here.
John Ludlow. Thank you. John Ludlow is from Through a Child's Eyes. John, give us a minute on your story.
Thank you, co-chairs and representatives. My name is John Ludlow. I'm from Wilsonville, Oregon. I was one of the biggest fighters of the prison when it was located up there. To a large extent, we fought for years. I was the dreaded enemy of the DOC, and then I became volunteer of the year at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. So there's a dichotomy there. But to tell you briefly what Through a Child's Eyes is, it's a program I wrote for Rotary, and it was adopted by the Department of Corrections and Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. I did that after becoming Santa Claus at their first year. And I sat there with a Santa Claus outfit on and cried, because these children, which were spoken of earlier, these precious children are 6 to 7 times more likely to become incarcerated during their lives because of their mother's incarceration. It's one thing when a father goes to prison, but it's another thing when a mother goes to prison, because they're their nurturers. And so often when you see a man go to prison, it's mom taking care of those children, and they can be saved. But these are particularly vulnerable children who are lacking in education, social skills, and certainly near the poverty line, a lot of them. What we do is we have two programs, the winter program, which we bring presents in for every inmate of inmate's child. Up to 300 children get served and get to sit on Santa Claus's lap and go home with a picture of Santa Claus and their mother. But the biggest program we have is in the summer, in which we feed 1,000 people. We have hundreds of volunteers inside the prison wall, surrounded by Constantiner wire, and I made the captain the first year we had this put up pink surveyor's ribbon, and he about died, versus caution, do not cross. But we have crafts, games, all the cotton candy, snow cone, and popcorn you can eat. We have organized games, again, hundreds of volunteers. And the cost every year for this entire program for two 6 month apart programs, which these mothers have to earn their right to be at these. So it's very reactionary to how they perform, and they desperately want to be there with their children in a loving, caring, hugging atmosphere that's completely different from visiting rooms. The cost of this program is around $14,000 to $16,000 a year. Mm. Period. There's no state funding. There's no state help. This is all privately raised funds from different ministries, from private individuals. But I'm here to tell you that it does make a difference. Those mothers and those children, and even the visitors, of course, of the inmates, they lavish us with praise on what it does to them, and they tell us how much of a difference it made in their lives and in the inmates' lives, and especially the children. The children are always redeemable. The children always can be loved, and they should be loved unconditionally. It doesn't matter what the inmate does, and frankly, we learned after the first year in this program, we never ask what the inmate does, because I don't care. What I care about is them and their future relationship for their children, or they will follow their mother.
Thank you, John. That's a nice surprise today. I didn't know you were coming, and I appreciate your testimony.
Real quick. Thank you.
We got to move on and have our
comment.
Is there coming up? I just want to thank you, John. I was worried you were going to leave, and I really appreciate hearing that, because this is powerful stuff and powerful work that you're doing.
Anytime you want to volunteer in the summer for a 4-hour stint in the prison, I tell you what, it'll change your life. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Now, Madam Chair, I'm passing the buck because I feel completely inadequate to sum up what we've heard today, but I have thoroughly enjoyed it. So I'm passing the buck and asking Carrie and Rick if they had a comment about what they heard, since you were here for the whole session. We appreciate it very much.
Really? Very interesting. Again, my name is Rick Nitti. I'm Executive Director of Neighborhood House in Portland and Vice President of the Board of Nonprofit Association of Oregon. Yes, for one word, help.
Well said.
But I want to just say how much we appreciate co-chairs Gilliam and Tomei and committee members the opportunity to present to you the wide array and the diverse nonprofit community that we have here in the state of Oregon. I was impressed by the passion, the faith, and the creativity that exists throughout our state. In concluding this discussion, I think it's important to recognize that safety net services in Oregon can only be secured through a collaboration from the faith community, nonprofits, and government. All are important. The role of government investment is critically necessary to leverage charitable donations, in-kind contributions, and volunteers. Without that investment, our system will break down. This is true particularly for our community's social safety net, but it's also true in our arts community, in our health community, and our education community, where nonprofits are all very much involved. So really, thank you very much for providing this time for us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Colleagues, thank you, Mr. Chair, for putting this.
Thank you all.
Together.
With gratitude to my committee, to my co-chair, and to everyone that came, I am now going to close the first informational hearing on community partnerships in nonprofits, and I close the House Committee on Human Services for today.